And we're going to get started now on sexual psychology. Now, sexual psychology is, at its easiest, a very broad and deep topic in itself. But we're going to be covering the necessary parts of sexual psychology so you understand what makes women sexually attracted to men, how you can leverage that for your own benefit, not manipulate, but leverage it, use it correctly, and be able to get to your sexual goals much quicker and more reliably. And in basically, as I said before, everything in here connects with each other. So this is going to improve your sexual confidence, which is therefore going to increase your speed in the whole roadmap of things, which is also going to eventually give you much more and better sexual performance. So let's start with, first of all, our first reality check of this section anyways, which is actually reality check number two. No magic here, right? There's no magic. There's no magic to what we're doing. There's no magic bullets per se. There's no magic in getting women attracted to you. There's no magic words you can say. I mentioned this before. There's no magic buttons you can push. Well, not literally anyways. Arthur C. Clarke had this great saying that he came up with. He's the author of 2001 and many other great science fiction novels. And one of the things he said was that any technology that's sufficiently advanced will seem like magic. You know, if you brought back an iPhone back into 16th century America, it would seem like magic. And of course, you'd probably get burned at the stake for being a witch. But you get the idea, right? Anything that seems like it's way ahead of its time is going to seem almost magical. And all it's really using is technology. And that's what we're using here. We're using technology to achieve our goals. So, yeah, I'm saying that there are no magic bullets, because a lot of guys out there will promise you the magic bullet for how to attract a woman in 5 easy steps, and it works every single time. Well, there's no such thing that works every single time, but there are tactics you can employ that will increase your odds and increase the probability of success dramatically. That's what we're talking about here. And they also are in line with your character and your morals. So, again, there's no magic, not literally magic, but the technology I'm teaching you will be, again, no hypnosis, not literally. In a way, you're going to be hypnotizing a person with your charisma, as we all know that works, right? You talk to people that have encountered great and influential politicians and orators and speakers and leaders. You know, you just listen, read some of the interviews with people who have encountered Bill Clinton, just as an example. I use him because he is a very powerful and charismatic person. A little bit egotistical, but, you know, that comes with the territory too. If you remove the marketing hype, I will give you the real results. That's what we're really trying to do here. And again, back to Arthur C. Clarke's statement, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. That was his exact saying. And I believe that. I really do. I believe that you can appear almost magical to a person simply by employing a much more sophisticated version of technology. And alpha sexual power is that technology. So there's your reality check. I want to make sure you're clearly understanding that there's no, I'm not going to be able to say flug-a-blah-blah-za or whatever this magic word is, and a woman's going to go, oh, God, I just want to sleep with you right now. Doesn't happen that way, right? We know that doesn't work like that. And even though we know that, there's still a part of us that would really like for it to be true, that we could pop a pill and walk up in front of a woman and suddenly be super sexually confident, because we're looking for that easy path, that easy route. It doesn't exist, at least not that way. But there are ways of doing it, just not the ones you might have suspected. I'm going to talk about prime movers for a second here. Prime movers are the things that influence women. These are the most important things to women. These are the things that drive them and the underpinnings of their sexual psychology. When you understand these, you're going to really understand women on a much deeper level. So take the time to go deeper in these topics if you have to. I'm going to cover them as much as possible here. But at the same time, you should also be looking up things like research articles, or just going online and finding the latest surveys. And, well, not surveys. Surveys are a bad form of research, because you're asking people to logically explain things that are not logical. But you do want to look up some of the research that's been done on attraction and how we react to the opposite sex, because there's plenty of them out there. The drive for connection is a prime mover with women. What is the drive for connection? It's actually her reason for being in a lot of ways. Women are driven primarily for a need for connection. Men, on the other hand, it's the need for significance and being important and feeling powerful. For woman, it's maintaining connections. And this goes back again to evolutionary psychology. She had to have good friendships, connections with other people in the tribe, so that she could have a stable power base, right? She could actually weather any storm if she had enough, a strong enough network of supporters and people who would back her up. And, you know, that translates into all areas of life. That's why women are so keyed in on maintaining those connections. That's the most painful thing to lose, is a connection. The need for appreciation and validation is very strong in women. Okay, this is where you see guys trying to meet this one as one of those upfront needs. They try to overappreciate women up front, and it feels kind of false and feels like false flattery. The need for appreciation and validation, though, is deeply woven into her psychology. She needs to feel like she's needed, and she needs to be validated through external opinions, external statements of her value and worth. She's always looking for that. She will also feel the most attraction for the dominant man in any group. Let me say that again. This is really important. She will feel the most attraction for the dominant man in any group. Whether you like it or not, she's going to feel it. I've been with women, and I remember this distinctly, being back at a time when I had a woman very attracted to me. She was my girlfriend at the time. Although I didn't understand a lot of the alpha male concepts and the alpha man concepts that I teach at the time, right? So what I found out was that she was actually much more attracted to other men that were coming in, but she's with me, right? So she had to make herself settle in a way in her brain. And every woman does this to some degree, because there's always going to be a new dominant man in certain situations, and you're just going to have to deal with that. But you must maintain dominance within your sphere of influence. Again, by context and group situation, because the dominant man in one situation is not the dominant man in another. You might be the head honcho, the dominant guy at work. You might be the boss, the manager, the big cheese. But maybe in your volleyball team or something like that, you're not. You're just another player on the team. Or chess club or whatever. But it differs by context and by where you happen to be. And that's what alpha attraction is about. Alpha attraction is this attraction to the person who appears to be the most competent, the most dominant in any situation. And you can be that guy in most situations, even if it's only subtly. Okay, you don't have to be the aggro guy, as we've talked about. It's not about being aggro and being a dick to people. It's about being the dominant man, and we'll talk more about how that works. Women also fear social judgment. They fear social judgment. This goes back to the thing we've talked about, is the slut complex. She doesn't want to be judged as being a whore, a slut, or a promiscuous woman in any way. So what will she do? She'll avoid that, because that's one of her primary motivators, prime movers, if you will. Think about the insults that are given, right? What's the worst insult you can give to a man? Pussy, right? Wuss. A total girl. You're a girl. You know, that's like the most insulting thing you can say to a guy. What's the most insulting thing you can say to a woman? Bitch, whore, slut. Really, it comes down to slut. And that really is the essence of what drives us, if you think about it. What's the worst and most damaging thing you can say to somebody, and then figure out why it hits them so hard. Slut does, because that's what a woman's another prime motivator for her is, to not appear as though she's promiscuous, because then she would not be able to get the stable support of a man, because he could never trust that the kids were his. She'd always be messing around on him. What kind of guy wants that? So women do fear social judgment quite a bit. Most women have experienced sexual threat. Most women have gone through an experience of sexual threat, and this goes from harassment all the way to abuse and possible rape in some situations. I think there's a statistic somewhere, I can't remember where I read it, but I think 10 to 15% of women have encountered a sexually abusive or rape situation. I'm totally pulling that number out of my butt. You'd have to look it up, but it's a significantly high number. Now, that's not including or really counting all the women that have encountered a sexually threatening situation, which is almost every single woman out there, okay? Guys simply do not understand a woman's constant fear or need to be careful around sexual threats and watching for sexual threat and physical domination. She's always watching for that. She's always in a state of kind of a little bit of skittishness over it. She finds a way to feel comfortable in her niche in the world, but at the same time, she knows that she doesn't have great physical strength. In the animal kingdom, there are some animals where the female is the larger of the animal. It's not so with humans. So she experiences sexual threat almost on a daily basis in a way. She has to be conscious of it anyways, cognizant of it. Doesn't mean she's living in paranoia and fear, but she is always aware of it. Another myth is that men dominate society. Okay, this is a myth that we work under, or we believe, and women know better. Women know better that men do not dominate society truly. Women have a complementary power that counterbalances any power that men have in society. So while it may seem that men earn more and we're more powerful in the workplace, think about it. Women control most of the wealth and the purchasing power in the United States, at least. They are the ones most in control of the money. And in a capitalist nation like the United States, what do you think that means? You got it. All the marketing, all the media, all the promotions, everything that's geared around selling is targeted towards women. And that's really important to understand. Now, women are more sexual than men. This is another one of those important movers and motivators that we need to know about, and that is that women are very, very sexually driven. Physical arousal is separate from psychological for a woman. This isn't the counterpoint to this, because while women are more sexual than men, and once they have been made to feel sexually secure and safe, and they can get the sex that they want, they are now in a position where they can get the sex they want. But they are also very much in control of their state of physical arousal. A woman can get all the way close to orgasm, and then, you know, one wrong thing, and everything's done, everything's shut off, everything comes to a complete halt. And you may have experienced this in your life. I know I've experienced it many times, where it comes right up to the finish line, and it's like, what? What the hell was that? It comes out of nowhere. And guys can't understand this, because once we're on the path, once we've got a boner, it's on, man. We're going all the way, one way or the other. If we have to run off to the bathroom to take care of business, that's what we're going to do. Physical arousal is separate from psychological arousal in a woman. That's what allows her to do what it is she needs to do to control the sexual threat, that perception of sexual threat, and maintaining her ability to control whether or not she gets pregnant, whether or not it's a willing sexual encounter. Women have two sexual templates. This goes back to more of the movers that motivate women. They have a provider template and they have a bad boy template that that motivates them and moves them. The provider template is the one where men will be the one that brings home the bacon, so to speak. He'll be the one that provides for her, gives her the safety of a house, income, support for her kids, keeps her safe physically, all that stuff. That's what the provider does. The bad boy, on the other hand, is the guy that is the edgier guy, but he's got risky genes. He's got the adventure seeking. He's got a much more wild side to him. There's a lot of things that go beyond what you may think of as traditional bad boy behavior. And again, I encourage you to delve deeper into this by going into my bad boy program to get more of the detailed explanation of how these two differ. Typically, the provider is what we think of as the nice guy. All right, she'll take this guy because he's willing, he's a perfectly good guy, he's not bad in any way necessarily. But when it comes to sexual turn-on and sexual aliveness and vibrancy, the bad boy beats him out just by sheer virtue of his extreme tendencies. And that's, again, something I explain more completely in my bad boy program, as well as my alpha masculinity program on how to get rid of your overwhelming Mr. Nice Guy. But those two sexual templates drive a woman. She finds those two interesting. And if you're asking yourself, well, geez, Carlos, so she finds the provider as being an attractive sexual model, then why don't I just do that? Well, the reality is that when it comes to courting women, the bad boy is still going to win out. She may eventually settle for the nice guy, but you want to give her the best of both worlds. And by doing so, you will lock her in. You'll keep her attracted to you for the long term. Because what ends up usually happening with the provider type or the provider template is that he ends up, he ends up being the nice guy, of course, but at the same time, he also loses the attraction over time. And whether she's had children with him or not, she's going to go off and find herself what she needs sexually. This is why the statistics about women and their sexual exploits and them cheating are becoming to light now, that women are much more sexually promiscuous than we thought, because they have a much better capability of keeping it on the down low. They keep it secret. They keep it hidden. Not to say that all women cheat, but all women do have this tendency in them to want that edge in terms of what they can get. And they think by virtue of the way the bad boy is, that he's going to give them a sexual experience unlike any other. And most times, they're right. In this program, I'm going to teach you how to do that for her, so you can be that bad boy in the bed for her. We all behave in accordance with our unique and our individual coping strategies. Okay? We all behave in accordance with our very unique and individual coping strategies. So we each have these strategies we use to maintain our sense of calm, peace, and security in life. We have coping strategies. How do we get by from day to day? I mean, if you didn't have coping strategies, every day would be a constant state of turmoil, a constant state of chaos for you. We all have our unique strategies for dealing with that, men and women. And that's really what a lot of these prime movers speak to, is that we all behave in accordance with them. When you understand how people have constructed their coping strategies, you'll have a better idea of how to handle them, how to work with them. Women are driven strongly by biology. And I emphasize strongly in this because you have to really understand they have a need to procreate. Okay, and I'm talking about the majority of women. Sure, there, you know, you've got gay women, you've got women that are just they're kind of almost asexual or not that interested in it. But on the whole, the majority of women really do, besides all the society and all the weird programming they get, the majority of women do have this need or this feeling of need to procreate, to have kids. Okay? It's not something you're going to get past with most women. I saw a comedian recently, his name is Joe Rogan. I guess he's the guy that is the host of that TV show, Fear Factor. And he was talking about the tricks that women play up front, where they are really, really, really nice, and they try to be the best girlfriend up front, and then they hit you with the crying fit, and they say, "Where is this going?" And that's when they lock you in, and they pussy whip you, and now you're theirs, basically. Well, it's a little harsh, but in a lot of ways, it is actually true. This need to have kids and then to establish those resources and security, it's a dual thing in her head that she knows is going on. Sure, women can support themselves in this day and age, but let's face it, a woman knows she's going to have to take time off to have a child eventually at the end of her term. She's going to have to take some time off to start raising that child, and she doesn't really want to give that over to anybody else. All right, contrary to what people might think, she doesn't really want to hand her kid over to somebody else to watch all day long while she goes to work. She would much rather be there with her kids, at least if she's in touch with that nurturing side of herself. So this need to establish resources and security and the need to procreate will drive her very, very strongly, which is why women are drawn to men with wealth, men who have accomplishments, men who are ambitious. All right, it's not something for the average guy to be resentful of. It's something just to understand, it's the way it is. It is what it is. It's not that women are gold diggers. They're looking to establish a safe and secure foundation for themselves. Very important to understand. Women are also confused by society, the same way men are. They're getting conflicting messages from the media, from just about every place on the planet telling them, oh, you can have your cake and you can eat it too. Meaning that you can go out there in the workplace and you can act like a man and have the success of a man, and then you can go home and you can have the relationship that you want. But the problem is that most women bring that masculinity from what they do during the day and they bring it home with them, and they don't understand how to turn it off and just be a woman and relax. They've got to be this thing that the society is programming them for. So they're very, very conflicted, as well as understand this whole career versus family thing. So society is confusing them. Just knowing these things, by the way, makes them excellent points of conversation with women. Because when you bring up the topic of women being drawn in these two directions with society, which is a great thing to talk about with women, you're going to find out, number one, how she feels about it. Number two, how connected she is to this topic, and how well she sees through the bullshit, how she sees through the media messages, how smart is she about this? Does she recognize that the same way that she behaves in the workplace is not going to serve her at home? Okay, I've talked to women where I'm like, whoa, I've been on a date with them thinking, there is no way I would want to date you long term. And I got through the date as best I could, or I got, whatever we got out of it, and that was it. Because you can just tell when certain women are programmed poorly, and it would take years to get rid of some of that. And you don't want that. You don't want to have to work, have a pet project of making a woman suitable for you. Choose a woman who's already where you want to be. That's the way to be successful, okay? Because remember, the number one decision you're ever going to make in your life that's going to decide whether or not you succeed or fail in life is who you team up with. who's going to be that special woman that you either marry or stick with for the long haul. She's going to make the biggest make most of that happen or not happen for you. Women have emotional chaos. Women live in a state of emotional chaos. Some of the forces you got to understand are the societal ones and the biological ones. I've been talking about each one of them separately here, but they do also command their own topics. Society, women are more powerfully influenced by her peers and driven by other women than most other things. Let me say that again. Women are more powerfully influenced by her peers and driven by other women than most other things. Women control a woman's life, not men. So when women are always complaining about how men are holding them back, the reality has been shown in many, many studies and many, many scientific explorations of this topic that really it's been coming down to women in a lot of ways that have been holding women back. One of the great myths of the whole feminist movement and the whole equality in the workplace has been around the subject of pay. The reality is that women were not being paid less overall. When you look at the statistics, they were not being paid less overall because they were women. They were being paid less overall because women tend to take more time off from the workplace to have children. So as a result, their skill sets fall behind, their value in the workplace can fall behind men's, because men don't have to do that, and typically didn't for a long, long time. That's changed quite a bit now. So that's where a lot of the difference came from in pay. Not because we were saying, Sheila is a woman and John is a man, we're going to pay John more because he's a man. In some cases it was, but in most cases it was not. Again, society also influencing through relationships. A woman's always looking at everybody else's relationship. She's looking for that ideal relationship and she wants it for herself. She's going to look at John and Mary and she's going to be like, oh, they have such a cool relationship. I want that. And then she's going to use that as a model and it's going to sit in her head and it's going to nag at her. It's going to poke at her because she wants that. That's the society programming you too, because society is also focused around relationships. Being single is something of a... it's almost like a scarlet letter, the big S on your chest. And that's not Superman. Biology. She has a clock. She has a biological clock, a ticking time bomb in her of how long she can have kids. That's going. Hormones. She has a hormonal balance inside her body that will change her thinking. It literally changes the way she thinks. I want you to really comprehend that. You have it too. It's called the backup of testosterone in your bloodstream that makes you want to bang anything that moves. But she has it too. And she has it and it does wild things to her physiology as well as her psychology. The childbearing thing we talked about. And the sex drive. Okay, the emotional chaos that she experiences and that force of biology in her sex drive. It's controlled by sexual stigma. So on one hand, she's got this incredible sexual power. On the other hand, there's society pushing back on that and constraining her and keeping her well back from where she would really like to be. If you create the environment where she can feel like she can have that, you get sexual freedom, liberation, and undivided sexual attention and devotion. Women delay sex to build power. Now, I'm going to tell you right now that a lot of things I'm going to say on this program are going to, they're going to make you go, geez, Carlos, that's pretty harsh, or wow, that's kind of not misogynist. Well, some may actually come across as being misogynist, or, isn't that kind of like woman-hating stuff? No, it's not. You have to understand, I appreciate women on every single level. Every woman, every one of them I appreciate. And you got to understand that there are certain things that are and true about each gender that we would rather not have to admit. Guys are driven by sex and tend to just jump at the opportunity. We cheat a lot because of it. Is that a good thing? No, but it is reality in a lot of ways. You can control it and you can set up situations differently, but that's the way it is. The same with women. Women do delay sex in many cases to build power. I'll give you an example here. It's called the strategic offense. This is where a woman will actually accuse you of being a player, and she'll do it very early on. It might be even in the first, it usually is actually in the first night she meets you. She'll accuse you of being a player, and what does that do to you? It puts you on the defense because she took the strategic offense. Now you, what do? You back off, and you fall into nicer guy mode to get her approval. Do you see what's happened there? She has taken a position of power over you by simply throwing something out there in a playful way. And she knows it works, and she knows how it works. So by, again, accusing you of being a player, it's not just a test, per se. It's a way to step up and maintain a certain level of control and power over you as a man. Now, does she consciously do this to be, like, lording it over you and commanding you and being, you know, the big pussy whip? No, it's not necessarily it, but it is in her system. And it's a test in some ways because she doesn't want you to give in. You can then, of course, show that you have the power and the masculinity to not fall for that. You don't fall back into nice guy behaviors just because somebody makes you feel, oh my God, does she think I'm a player? Does she think I'm one of those bad guys? I'm a nice guy. I really am. Okay, so, again, that's one of the little ploys you have to understand about women is they do delay sex to build power. They control the sex sometimes to maintain a certain level of power and strength with men because she can. Women often date multiple men without any guilt or conscience issues. This one really freaks men out because I've talked to many guys that had no idea whatsoever that they were actually being double dated, if you will. That she was dating other guys at the same time she was dating him. He thought he was the only guy in the arena. But guess what? There's always more. You don't realize it, and she won't let you, and she'll tell you everything, and she'll make you feel guilty for even thinking about dating another woman, but she's dating other guys, or at least seeing them in some way, or testing the waters, or you know, just going out with them even in social situations and analyzing them for relationship potential. Because, again, a woman has very sophisticated social control mechanisms and very, very effective manipulation mechanisms. Most women can get the man they want. They know they can if they use their wiles effectively. So, again, without you ever even knowing it, she's probably been dating other guys, especially if it's new in early stages of a relationship. Once it gets a little bit more set and certain, she's going to be in there monogamously right off the bat too, because she wants to put her energies in the one relationship to keep that connection. Women need to fix men in order to make a relationship interesting. Now, again, this one sounds kind of mean and nasty in a way, but it's true. In a lot of ways, women love to have that feeling of having a pet project, and this keeps the relationship interesting and very, you know, entertaining, engaging for them on a certain level. And what this is it's an internal investment strategy for her. It keeps her in the game, all right? When a woman doesn't feel like she's got to do much to keep a relationship going or keep the connection going, she gets a little bored and she gets a little uneasy because women want to be at work on the relationship. I'll give you an example. A long time back, I was, this goes back maybe 10 years, I was doing volunteer work at a children's hospital in the Midwest, in Kansas City, in Missouri, when I lived there. And one of the things I was taught there was that for children, playtime during the day when they play with their toys and play around in their room, that's their work. In other words, that's what they need to survive, to thrive and grow, is they need play. Play is an essential and critical component of a child's life. If they can't play, they kind of die inside. Well, the same thing is true with women. So take out the play and substitute fixing the guy. And you see what happens here. She has the thing that makes her feel engaged and work and really there and present in the relationship. Without it, it becomes a little boring. It becomes a little weird. Women need it. And that's why they will, on occasion, freak out just to stir up some shit. This goes right back to, you know, you see a woman or you have a woman in your life and she just does this out of nowhere. And you're like, where did that come from? Things were going great. Why did you have to do that? Why did you have to stir up shit? Now you know why. It's a way for her to get re-engaged in the relationship. It's a way to test her connection with you. It's like pushing all the buttons on a computer and just seeing what happens, and then you come rushing in to fix it. This shows her that you're actually engaged and involved in the relationship. It's an investment strategy. It's internal to her as well as with you. It gets you back and engaged and involved as well. Women have had sex with many more men than they think they have. They genuinely will distort this in their head so that they will have sex. I think the numbers now are well into the, most women, it's well into the double digits. A lot of women have sex with, you know, upwards of 20 to 30 guys before they'll finally settle down with a guy. But what do they define that 20 or 30 number to be? 4, 5, right? It's always a single digit number. Some will modify their number according to made-up rules in their head. Like, oh, that one didn't count. It was Christmas, and we were breaking up, and I was going to break up with him, and it didn't count. What do you mean it didn't count? He stuck his dick in you. It counts. Okay? Not to be like Joe Stoy, a stand-up comedian here, but you get what I'm saying. Women will change these rules to suit their psychological makeup. A woman can't sit there and think, wow, I'm a slut. I'm a whore. I'm a slutty whore. She can't do that, right? Nobody thinks about themselves as bad. As I said before, Adolf Hitler didn't think he was doing anything bad. He just thought he was doing the right thing, right? As bad as it was, he thought he was doing the good thing. Women, at the same time, will not want to think of themselves as being slutty or whore. So what do? They create situations and rules in their head that allow them to not count certain guys. So I guarantee you that every single woman that you have ever dated that told you that she has only slept with two other guys has probably slept with about 10 to 15. It's just one of those facts, and you got to get over it. And if it makes you go, and get all mad, look at yourself, man. Don't you go holding yourself to the double standard at the same time, all right? Let that one go. That jealousy is another indicator, again, of an immature sexual response. Women do not see lying or deception as being lying or deception. Really, they don't. Some of the tactics they use would be out and out considered manipulation and deception. But manipulating the truth is a woman's tool of control. It's mostly about controlling how you see her. Think about what a woman goes through to present a certain image to you. She wears certain clothes that flatter her figure and present her as being a sexual woman and being an attractive woman. She wears makeup. Think about the amount of work that women put into makeup. When you see a woman without her makeup and her makeup on, there's a distinct difference in a lot of women, and they really work at it. They work hard. Another example here of this is that the more she likes you, the more she will lie to you to maintain the image that she wants. Women will actually lie more to a guy that they're more emotionally involved in to keep up the appearances that suit them. Okay. Now, I'm not saying that all women are liars and they don't give you any truth and none of their feelings are real or any of that. But you got to realize that on a subtle level, women are shaping the truth around you. They're using that as a way of controlling your perception, how you think about her, and her own self-validation and self-image. She will use denial and self-deception as a means to the end that she wants, which maintains her self-image as being pure. Angelic, white as the driven snow. Please don't go too far with this stuff. I'm giving you some stuff here that, again, you have to take with a grain of salt. It's not as extreme as being always like this, but it's also not extreme as never being like this, which is a key distinction to understand. She will use denial, she will manipulate the truth in order to maintain the reality that she wants for herself. You do the same thing, whether you realize it or not. She's just doing it in this particular way. And women function on a layer of abstraction. Layer of abstraction. What do I mean by that? This is a technical term. It actually came from computers back in the day when I was doing a lot of Microsoft engineering. Not anymore. I'm all Mac now. But there is a layer of behavior. In a computer, let me step back. Abstraction means that there is a layer of something going on that protects what's below it from what's going on outside it, which means a layer of abstraction means when you're on your iPhone, for example, when I use this iPhone and I bring up an application on there, there's a layer that's stopping me from getting at the real guts, from being able to change things that are in the circuits and the chips that are inside that phone. Okay, and that layer of abstraction is a layer of protection, because if I did the wrong thing, I would crash my phone every 5 seconds, right? If this phone let me go in and tweak things that were not what I needed to get at, it would crash the phone. So what Microsoft and what Apple and what all these companies do is they create these systems that allow us to interact with them without breaking what's going on beneath them. That's what a layer of abstraction does. It keeps you separate. It keeps you removed enough so that you don't hurt what's going on inside or yourself. So women function on this layer of abstraction. There's a layer of behavior that she exhibits and demonstrates that hides her underlying motivations. Sometimes this is called womanese. It's the language they speak. right? They speak womanese. These words that they use and the way they say things are not literal the way guys would like them to be. But when you understand how this works, this layer of abstraction, these words she's saying are really protecting her self-image, what's going on beneath, it's actually very predictable and very easy to understand. But it's still fluid, which means it changes from time to time. The rules and the regulations and the whys and the whatnots about how women communicate are subject to interpretation depending on the situation, right? Which means it's fluid, like a military situation. And that's what's most frustrating to men, is that sometimes it can seem like the rules change on you at her whim. So rather than being frustrated about that, you have to maintain your solidarity and steadfastness around what you understand about women, your sexual power. When you do, you're going to find that those times when women change the meaning of things to suit themselves, they just don't matter, because you can cut through the bullshit and get to what's really the problem, really the issue. Because when a woman does that, when she changes the meaning of a situation or the meaning of words to suit her, what it really means is she's trying to get to a result that's just not going to happen for her if she just tells you directly. She's being indirect. And that's the layer of abstraction that most women use, is being very indirect so that she can stay in touch with her constant flow, her constant emotional turmoil, emotional fluidity, if you will. That's what she's really doing. So again, you're going to be frustrated with a woman's communication style. It's just a fact of life. We all communicate. We all go through it. Every guy goes through it, and women go through it with guys. I don't know why we don't usually typically change it quite the way they do. And you're going to find yourself doing this a lot. But when you get to the point of understanding how womanese works, how they're talking, why they talk the way they talk, and how it works, you won't be anywhere near as frustrated. Again, this is not a communication program in the sense of learning how to talk to women. I have a program called How to Talk to Women, if you want that, and where I can go into much more detail. We're just going to talk about the sexual energy within conversations and within your attraction interactions with women. So there you go, some very critical understanding regarding prime movers. These are the elements of women and why they work the way they work. Prime movers have to be understood because they're like the pistons that work in the engine. That's what makes everything go. And women fire on a 4,000 piston engine that you've got to really just every so often take a look at and understand. They have motivations of differing kinds, and they're different than men, and it's frustrating for guys. But if you accept them, you'll have no problem working through them and getting to sexual power. Next up, we're going to talk a little bit about supernatural influence and then move right into what I call the female typology. I'm going to explain the key critical components of understanding what the differences are between certain women. And you're going to be able to read them and know right off the bat how to adjust your approach and how to be sexual with those women individually, so that you don't try and apply a one-size-fits-all style of seduction to women. Come on back for the next section. Now we're talking about supernatural influence. Supernatural influence sounds like a new seduction program, doesn't it? What it really is about is that it's easy to influence a woman when you know what moves her. Now I know back in the reality check, I talked about how, you know, none of this stuff is magic, none of this stuff is hypnosis, but on a certain level, there is a certain level of covert influence going on. You're always influencing somebody. This is not mean or manipulative, tricky stuff. We are always trying to manipulate people into doing what we want them to do. We're always doing that. And we have a very distinct set of guilt factors built around that in a lot of ways. But we have to get past that and realize that when we're coming from a place of integrity, when we're coming from a place of honesty and honor, we don't have to worry about those things, okay? Because we're doing the right thing. The ultimate analogy to what you're doing when you're seducing women or when you're trying to get a woman to feel attraction for you, which is, it's a good thing, by the way. This is a good thing. We're not using women. This is not what we're about. But when we're doing this, what we're doing is the essential selling them on something. This is an analogy that's come up time and time again. I'm sure you've heard it over and over again, but it's very, very accurate. You are in sales, my friend. And the one thing, if you look at the sales industry, the actual salespeople that are out there today, The salespeople that succeed are always the salespeople that genuinely believe in their product. It's hands down, the 80% of sales go to the 20% of salespeople who, number one, work, number two, believe in what they're selling. That's all they really, really need to get success. The unfortunate thing is the other 80% of salespeople who are not producing, and they're also producing only maybe 20% of those sales, they don't believe really in the product. They have that lack of security, that lack of confidence in their product. The same thing is true of you. The one thing that you can do to totally turn this game around for yourself is to believe in your product. Believing in your product is the number one thing that's going to set you apart from every other guy out there, because your product is you, and most guys do not believe in themselves. That was one thing I worked on very, very hard over the years. I've always had a strong sense of self, and that has always gotten me by. But when it came to really getting this stuff down, having that kind of influence with women, believing in the product was absolutely the number one factor. So remember, it's easy to influence a woman when you know what moves her, okay? Connection and a fear of abandonment. Don't use that fear of abandonment in a manipulative way. Don't threaten her and her security in your relationship as a way of trying to get her to come pull closer, okay? That was a manipulative thing that I've tried in the past. I'm ashamed to say, but yes, I actually did that. By threatening the security of the relationship, you actually create a very bad environment to have a woman trust in you, to feel safe in you, and to give you the kind of affection and connection that you're looking for. She'll always hold back if she really thinks that there's a chance that things are kind of have the rug pulled out from under her. Now, some women are built this way. Some women are just have a constant sense of abandonment that's lingering around the corner, and those are issues. And we know what we do with issues, don't we? We try and get rid of those as much as possible. If you've got a woman with issues, please do not spend your life trying to fix that woman just because you get hung up on her being the one. There is no such thing as the one. Every woman you meet could be the one if you knew what to do. I want you to be able to identify the primary types of women. That's what we're going to get out of this part of the program, is you're going to understand the simple cross-sections of behavior, what's common among all women, and then we're going to focus only on the kind of behavior that you can actually work with, that you can do something with, not only genuinely and authentically, but honorably and honestly. So keep in mind, there are simple cross-sections of behavior that are very common among women and among types of women. So you're going to have a group of women, and there's going to be something common to them. Another group of women, and what's common to them, and what works with them. You're going to use sexual kung fu to match her skills. A woman already has relationship skills. She already has these things built in to a certain degree. She just knows intuitively a lot of the stuff that we're working on consciously. It's the way of the world, and that's what we have to get used to. But at the same time, you need to have sexual kung fu to be able to match her in the arena. The simple model is this. There are inner drives and there are outer drives. Let's talk about each one of these really briefly. We have biology and we have psychology. Talked about this briefly also. Biology being the hormones and the relationship to her body. Those are the inner drives in a woman. Okay, so as we progress here, we're going from supernatural influence. What I'm talking about right now is going to lead directly into the female typology. So I want you to know where we are in the sequence of things. So again, her hormones and then her relationship to her body are some biological things that she has going on inside her inner drives. This is the simple model of where we're going to divide, if you will, a woman's psychology. The psychology aspects are the rules she has in her head and the amount of neuroticism that work around those rules. Neuroticism is, I don't want to go to a very, I don't want to fall back on a very clinical definition of it, but it's all those wacky kind of crazy things that go on in your head. It's the craziness, right? The neurotic behavior is the stuff that it sometimes can borderline. If you're looking at a spectrum, on this side is completely mentally healthy behavior. And over here on the other side is complete insanity. The first step towards insanity is neurotic behavior in a lot of ways, okay? And that's okay. We all act neurotic from time to time. How much and how long are we in that neurotic state? That's what you have to watch for. And with women, it's much more common. Men can be neurotic too. We just don't go quite there as often as women do. All right, so the rules that a woman sets up for herself and the neuroticism that surrounds those rules, those form the focus of the inner drives. The outer drives are society. society drives you. Her immediate social circle is going to have probably the most impact. So I want you to watch for that. I want you to know how to handle that. Culture in general, meaning there's our immediate social circle that impacts her and directly influences her, but then there's the culture that surrounds a woman. And we know what culture is like here in the United States and other countries. It's getting very similar. Another outer drive is, how was she brought up? Her upbringing is going to determine a lot of the female typology that we're going to talk about. So that upbringing aspect. Personality typing. This one's pretty big, so we're going to get deep here. But this is good stuff. This is really, really good stuff. Not only for you to understand yourself, but to be able to use this with women, freaking fantastic stuff to be able to use. You're going to come up with your own personality typing eventually. I want to kind of clarify this a little bit. Your personality typing that you'll come up with inside your own head is going to be a kind of a combination of everything that you've learned up until this point about self-development, and it will continue to evolve. I find that mine evolves all the time. And again, you have to understand that as these things progress, as you've been learning them and using them over your lifetime, I've been using them for quite a while, they do evolve and they become very personal. So you're going to come up with your own very personal way of figuring out a woman's personality type. It's going to differ from what I'm teaching you here eventually, but this can be a foundation for you. If you've never done this before, this stuff is critical, because you'll really get an idea of how to break down a person's personality and figure them out. Figure out what motivates them. Figure out how to get them moving in the same direction as you want them to go, which is, of course, a win-win situation. Typically, a primary and a secondary behavior. This is the way I think about it, and this is how it's evolved for me, is you can think about people in terms of their primary behavior and then their secondary behaviors. What do I mean by this? There's usually one prime mover, one prime motivator in a person's life, and one, sometimes more, secondary movers that really, you know, impel a person to do a certain thing. I'll give you an example. My prime mover in life is accomplishment. Being able to check things off of a to-do list. I have this to-do list actually right here on my desk that I use from day to day, and I do it's the things to do type thing. It's simple. It's one sheet of paper and a pen, and that's all I've ever used, and it works like a champ. I know some people try these computer versions and they just don't resonate with me. I have to see it on my desk. It has to be in my face. My prime mover is being able to check things off of that list and feel like I got something done that day. If I can check off a couple of things and I can look back on it and go, yeah, I got some stuff done. I got shit done. I used to call myself the king of GSD, getting shit done. Get stuff done. Get it done. Get it done. Now, of course, that can be taken to extremes, and that can become neurotic behavior, and it did for me for quite a while. But that's my prime mover. That's what I want to feel every day. I've got to feel that sense of accomplishment. So I structure my day so that I get that sense of accomplishment. I make sure that I don't go through a whole day and feel like, damn, man, I didn't finish anything. I didn't get anything done. All right. My secondary movers would be things like, well, my drive for family and for the connections that I have within my social circle, my social network. That's a secondary mover for me, very important to me. Achievement and growth are also a very big secondary mover for me. I don't move away from pain as much as I gravitate towards what I consider to be like ideals of pleasurable experience. So knowing those things, the prime movers, the biggies, and then the secondary ones, which are the little ones that will come up from time to time, that's how I've been able to type a lot of people and figure them out fairly quickly. Critical aspects are, first of all, 75% of your seduction strategy. Most of the pickup artist material works that you're going to read out there, that you're going to find from time to time on the internet, from books, programs like mine and others. But what it doesn't handle are the variances that you're going to experience in the levels of resistance. Okay, they also don't always address the different female personality types and psychologies that are out there. So that's really 75% of your seduction strategy there. So the resistance factor, what is the resistance factor? The resistance factor is this. This is a very particular factor of female psychology, and it's very important for you to figure out a woman is to know what her resistance factor is. You need to uncover what her factor rating is. Number one is a low resistor. Number 10 is a high resistor. Now you're asking yourself, what the hell is a resistor? What is her relationship to sex? That's what we're talking about here. It's not related to her moral compass, okay? It doesn't really have anything to do with whether or not she thinks sex is bad or good, although it can be related to that, good, bad, whatever. But resistance overall to the concept of having sex. This is the driving motive. This is a prime mover in women, and you can detect this one fairly quickly in women. There are women who have a very loose and liberal attitude towards sex, and there are women that have a very conservative and strict attitude towards sex, meaning that they're less likely to jump into it quickly. A more liberal or more easygoing chick is going to be quicker to sleep with because she's a little bit more relaxed about it. She doesn't have the neurotic behavior in her head built up. Does that make sense? I hope that does. So number one is a low resistor. Number 10 is a high resistor if we're talking about this on a scale. It's the first factor that you have to understand about a woman to really adequately type her personality. And as we go into the typology that I talk about next, what is her relationship to sex? You need to always be asking yourself that. And you always have to kind of have that in the back of your mind. Not as an agenda, but as a place to go when the conversation opportunities present themselves. High resistors. Let me give an example of what high resistors are like here. By example, the high resistors are a 10 on the scale, okay? Resistors have high significance for sex. In other words, sex is very important to them. They have a lot of significance built around it. They have a lot of meaning in it. They can be closed off sometimes about talking about sex. Doesn't always happen this way, but it's a frequent trait. Does she deny her sexuality or her sexual needs or her sexual desires? That's a question to ask, and that indicates her high resistance or low resistance. Does she view sex as very sacred, as being very black and white? That's another way to determine whether or not she's a high resistor. Does she use sex as a weapon? That one I found to be very, very true, is that more often than not, it's not to say that low resistors can't do this at the same time, but high resistors use sex as being a weapon or a power and influence tool. They really do leverage it that way. This one's pretty interesting, and it's another indicator. Does she keep a lot of secrets? Is she a secretive person? If she's a secretive woman, she tends to be much more of a high resistor, okay? If this is combined in a low resistor woman, in other words, a much more liberal or easygoing woman when it comes to sex, but she's also very secretive, that indicates a high level of neuroticism. It's a very small segment, but it's something to watch out for as a red flag. But on the whole, most women that keep a lot of secrets tend to fall into the high resistor element of the scale. She was brought up, I'll give you a little bit of insight from what her upbringing was. She was brought up very socially aware of herself and very, very, very keenly dialed into what her social persona appears like to other people. Is she very shy about sex? Does she kind of get embarrassed about the topic? Is she shy around the whole thing? This is the kind of woman that when you first sleep with her, she's going to leave most of her clothes on. Does she have a lot of shame or shame complexes built around the topic of sex? Very, very important, because that's really where a lot of this comes from. Her mother might have taught her that, you know what? Liking sex means you're slutty. Liking sex means you're a whore. Good girls don't do that. Chances are she's probably almost never cheated. A high resistor has probably never cheated, or at least has justified in her head that she's never cheated. I find with high resistors that there tends to be a lot of denial, a lot of the rules that I was telling you about, where women will take a certain sexual encounter and declassify that. They're going to say that, oh, that wasn't sex. I was, it didn't count. I was drunk. It didn't count. I was in California. It didn't count. I was awake. You know, whatever it was, whatever the situation was, she has a way of justifying it not counting against her. Those women typically can typically be high resistors. Very critical of other women's sexual behavior. This is also really important. When you see a woman who's very critical about another woman's sexual behavior, it's usually an indicator that she's high on the resistance scale. Sex is very important. Okay, and when I say important, it's not necessarily important for her to get to, but it has a high level of significance in her head. Very important to her. Very, again, sacred. Sex is a landmark in relationship status for this kind of girl. A high resistor is going to make the act of sex mean something. It's a significant landmark in your relationship. She will actually remember the date. She'll build up all kinds of significance and meaning around it because it's important. She plays sex as a game with rules. Okay, this goes back to the power thing a little bit. She's going to play sex as a game with rules and also with power inherent in it. So she's going to try and know all those rules, she's going to try and control those rules, and she's going to try and manipulate those rules to her benefit. Very few one-night stands with this kind of girl. very little cheating, and very few one-night stands. But she does want you to keep trying and trying and trying. So here's the factor that I want you to keep in mind. With a high resistor, she's going to be resisting your sexual advances, but she still wants you to keep trying. It's not that she doesn't want to have sex, because she will eventually. It's that she's going to want you to keep putting in the effort to keep her feeling as if she's sexually desirable. Do you get how that works? Women want you to keep trying and her being able to keep shutting you down. You're thinking about it as being rejection, but you know what she's thinking of it as? Oh, he is into me. This is great. Oh, no, not right now, sweetie. Oh, this is good. This feels good. Because it's a tool of redemption for her in a lot of ways. It's a tool of admiration. It's a tool of basically feeling desired as a woman. Remember, her sex is her power. A high resistor has an understanding in her head that sex and having sex is her power over men, and she's going to hold on to that power with all she's got. So be aware of that. Easier to sneak past her alpha tests with persistence. This is one of the things that's good about a high resistor, is that it's the techniques that I'm teaching you actually help you get past a lot of the resistance with your persistence. You're going to get past a lot of her testing, a lot of her issues, by being consistently alpha. Very important in the big picture, especially with a high resistor. Now, low resistors, the other side of the coin. Let's talk about them. First of all, sex is not a big deal. Just isn't. Not a big deal at all to them. They're very open about sex. They're more experimental. She's the one that's going to be more likely to try a whole bunch of different positions or sex in public or things like that. Some of the stuff that we're going to talk about in this program. She's basically easier to have sex. Overall, she's going to be much easier to get into bed. There's less overall resistance. And you might be asking yourself, well, geez, Carlos, why do we even need to study with this girl? Well, the women do typically tend to flock to either end of the spectrum. So if you're looking at low resistance to high resistance, 1 to 10, women really, if you were to graph it out, there'd be big bunches of women here near closer to 1 and big bunches of women over here near 10, but very few that are kind of floating around in between for the most part. They tend to gravitate towards either end of that spectrum. You will find women in between, and I was just thinking right off the top of my head, my good friend Joe Bovino put out this book called The Field Guide to Chicks of the United States, and he actually rates the promiscuity of each woman. And it's funny because when you look at it, there aren't that many women in between. They really do fall into the, I'm going to hold back on you, or I'll give it up a lot earlier. Not a big deal. Think stripper personality. If you've ever met or hung around with strippers, they have this personality. They are the ultimate in low resistors, okay? You got to understand that a woman that works in that industry has to have a very, she has to be somewhat in touch with her feelings about sex. And not feeling neurotic about them or guilty about them. She's got to be able to do that to do her job. She's going to have had many more sexual partners in the long term. She will have had a lot more guys in her life. She'll have slept with a lot more guys. She may not tell you about them all, but she will have had a lot more. Sex is not going to assure a relationship with this girl. And you got to understand that's going in, because a lot of guys approach every woman with this blanket approach, and they don't realize that a low resistance woman who's very cool and laid back about sex is not going to immediately assume that there's a relationship by virtue of the fact that she had sex with you. Okay, so remember that. She doesn't place the same significance on sex that the high resistor does. Harder to get love. It's a little harder to get love from this girl because she may be a little jaded. She may have more defenses, more guards up. But when you do, it's really, really devoted. It can be really, really strong. All right? She's much more sensitive to guys who think that sex is the end game. In other words, a low resistance woman is going to see through any ploys that a guy has to get to just sex. All right? The high resistance girl is not going to care that you're necessarily a guy that sees that sex as the end game, because remember, that's part of her power. Her power is the fact that she counts on you wanting sex, and she can hold back from it. And in between those two extremes is her ability to control you. So she doesn't mind it. The low resistance girl is going to be much more sensitive to this. She's going to know it, and she's going to look at you and go, you're one of those guys, huh? That thinks sex is a big deal, that it's the end game, the be-all, end-all. Right. And she's going to know. She's going to see through that, and she's going to understand what kind of guy you are. A much higher importance on masculinity with this kind of girl. Okay, you do need to have it for a high resistor, but honestly, I've seen a lot of high resistors turn into those women that kind of take over ownership of the relationship anyways, so it really doesn't matter in some cases. She will eventually lose attraction, just like any other woman, but it's less of an issue. It's a much higher importance for a low resistance woman, the cool laid back chick about sex. She's going to have less importance on the masculinity aspect of it. Or I'm sorry, a higher importance on the masculinity aspect of it, because it's a critical component of her being able to feel safe with you. She'll test you and she'll basically want to make sure that everything is for real, because she's more perceptive in a lot of ways. She's going to have a higher overall level of self-esteem. This is important to understand. I have found on the whole that the low resistance chicks will have a higher overall level of self-esteem. Don't get me wrong, there are a lot of chicks in this group though that are low resistors by virtue of the fact that they get their self-esteem from having sex with guys. That's a very important slice, and you can pick them out. That kind of a woman, you have to be able to see for who she is quickly, because she's a special case of low resistor that you have to watch out for. That self-esteem issue thing is going to catch you and bite you in the ass. She'll also see, the low resistance girl, the ones a little bit more hip, will also see through pickup artist games a lot more quickly and easily. So that's why you got to be careful with that. And again, another reason that a lot of guys don't get the cool chicks with a lot of their pickup artist routines. She doesn't have a problem with one-night stands. It's not a big deal to her. Okay, she's had casual sex before. She may or may not have any issues around it, but it's not a big deal for her as much as it is for the high resistance girl. She needs more long-term romance to get a relationship. This is a key differentiator in the low resistance chick. When you come up against a chick who's a little bit more cool, laid back in this realm of low resistance, she's going to need much more long-term romancing from you to get her engaged enough to want to connect with you and be in a relationship with you. Okay? Because she's going to see through a lot of the other stuff. She's going to have to see genuine emotion is going to be more important to her. Is what I'm really getting at with this. True emotion and true, this is a different kind of persistence to get through to her if you want to have her for a relationship. She typically needs a more balanced alpha man to keep her. And when I say balanced alphaman, it's more of a little bit more of the Renaissance man. He's a guy that can dabble in a lot of other things and not be stuck too strictly to the levels of what is masculine and what is not. In other words, you got to be a little bit more in touch with your emotions. Not a wuss, but you got to be a little bit more in touch there. Have to have a little bit of a sensitive side, but again, not overly sensitive. You don't wear your heart on your sleeve. What are the other areas? Being more open maybe to artistic and creative exploits, because she's probably going to have an artsy mind. A lot of the chicks that I've met and been with on the low resistance end of the spectrum have had really creative minds. It seems to be a coordination there. The artsy girl typically is a little bit more liberal with her sexuality. Not necessarily less neurotic, though. And more reckless overall. This particular kind of girl is going to take more risks. She's going to be a little bit more risky with her behavior. She may have tattoos. She may do adventure sports. She may have weird piercings. She's going to be a little bit more risky in some cases. So there you go. The two important distinctions that I want you to understand before we get into typology are the high resistors and low resistors of the world. Really, really important to understand how they work. With women, this is going to be probably the key differentiator in typing their personality. You'll learn a lot of other things when I start talking about Myers-Briggs and the Enneagram and the Big Five. But overall, the resistance factor is critical. Let's talk really briefly about Myers-Briggs, okay? Myers-Briggs and NLP overall. You're probably familiar by now, if you've gone through any of my programs, with the Myers-Briggs breakdown. If you're not, I'm going to explain it to you really briefly. I will tell you that my type is INTJ, and I'll explain where I fit in these as we go through them. But Myers-Briggs is a very simple personality typing, uses four factors, and you're on a spectrum in each one of these factors. The first one is introvert and extrovert. Keep in mind that this is related back to a lot of Carl Jung's work. So introvert and extrovert do not necessarily mean socially withdrawn for the introvert and gregarious for the extrovert. It means, where do you get your energy? Where do you recharge? Like, I recharge by being alone a lot of times. I can flip-flop. That's why I'm kind of a borderline. I flip-flop between I and E quite a bit. But I think overall I can type myself as an introvert. I get my energy from being alone. I prefer reflection, the inner world of action, direct energy and attention most naturally and most often to the internal world of facts, ideas, thoughts, feelings, and memories. That's how you classify the introvert. The extrovert prefers the action and the outer world of people and things. They direct their energy and attention most often and most naturally to the external world. All right, so you can kind of get an idea of the difference between the introvert and extrovert. Again, none of these typings means anything negative or positive per se. They're all, I forget what the word is, they're all amoral, if you will. They don't really mean good or bad. They just mean type. TNF, the next factor, is thinking or feeling. I'm a thinker, as if you couldn't tell that, right? I'm a thinker. And thinkers prefer in decision-making to use logic, cause and effect reasoning, and impersonal analysis to come up with the principles that will guide their decisions in most cases. The feeling type prefers to make decisions through a process of evaluating. Their filter is their personal values and empathy for other people, which they use to assess the impact of options on people, so they are much more tied to their feeling. These first two you're going to find are pretty easy to figure out on their own, right? You kind of know the difference between a thinker and a feeler. You get the idea there. S and N. S and N are sensing or intuition. And they use an N there because if they use the I, we would get confused up here. So that's why the N is used. Sensing, S, prefers to focus on the immediate reality. They notice events in the order in which they occur, and they give information in the same way. They notice what is actual and present, the information taken in by the five senses, sight, hearing, touch, smell, and taste. Okay, so that's a person that's very built around what they can perceive, they can really sense. Intuition is a person who's going to be a little bit more abstract and imaginative rather than practical. And they're more excited about future possibilities than present realities. Remember that one. That'll come in handy when you're interacting with women. More excited about future possibilities than present realities. They look at the big picture to get an overall impression of what's happening. That's the difference between sensing and intuitive. Now, judging and perceiving, in my opinion, is the hardest to figure out or the hardest to understand because it's a little bit different. J is for judging, P is for perceiving. The judger prefers their lives to be planned and orderly. Perceivers prefer their external world to be open and flexible. That was the best definition I could find for these two that made it very simple to understand in a heartbeat. I wish I had learned that like 10 years ago or whenever I first learned about this particular typing. I took this a long time back, by the way. So again, judging and perceiving, key differentiator there is whether they like their lives to be planned and orderly or open and flexible. Of course, you knew I was a J, right? I'm very much planned and orderly. That's a simple breakdown of Myers-Briggs personality typing, and that tells you quite a bit about a person, and it's a very simple model to understand. That's why I really like it, and I highly recommend you read more about it. I've barely skimmed the surface on that, but a great way to figure out a person. Break them down into introvert-extrovert, thinking-feeling, sensing-intuition, and judging-perceiving. Those four categories will tell you quite a bit about a person. The Enneagram. The basic circle of the Enneagram is this, okay, the Enneagram, and I'm not going to get into a lot of detail on this one because you look at it and the first thing you go is, whoa, dude, I'm not learning that. What it's really saying here is if you're a personality type 1, that it points directly to 4, this is your progression through this circle of how you grow and how you open up new facets of your personality. You see how they connect? That's all this thing is showing you. So I'm going to close it right now. Forget you saw that. But I will tell you about the different types because this breakdown of the 9 types, or excuse me, the 9 types, it's important to understand. And I'm going to use this, I'm going to leave this mostly as reference. I'm not going to read all of this and go through all of it with you right now, but I want you to understand what these breakdowns are. And if you find who you are in them, everybody finds a little bit of themselves in each one, it will tell you how you can use this tool to progress and grow. Number 1 is the reformer. The reformer wants to make the world perfect. The reformer has a compulsive need to live life the right way, improve the self and others, and to avoid anger. This is one I've fallen into quite a bit. Again, I'll leave this as reference material for you. It's in the ebooks as well as the reference mind map, so you can get this other detailed information from there. So don't worry if I'm closing it up too soon. Boop! It's done. Number 2 is the helper. The helper focuses on the needs of others. The helper has a compulsive need to be loved and appreciated, to express positive feelings to others, and to avoid being seen as needy. that's so funny too, because you think of the helper as really being a little bit needy sometimes. That's the number two personality type. Number three is the motivator. The motivator is the achievement and success-oriented person. The motivator has a compulsive need to be productive and successful and to avoid failure. That one is mine. Okay, that one I pretty much own. I have to admit, that one describes me to a T. Number four, the individualist wants to be special and unique. The individualist has a compulsive need to understand their feelings, to be understood, to search for the meaning, the missing meaning of life, and to avoid being ordinary. You know, that describes a lot of our politicians and a lot of our personalities in the media quite a bit, the individualist. Number five is the thinker. The thinker tries to figure out life. The thinker has a compulsive need to know and understand the universe, to be self-sufficient, to be left alone, and to avoid not having to having the answer or looking foolish. Number six, the loyalist. The loyalist is committed to being faithful and dependable. The loyalist has a compulsive need to receive approval, feel taken care of, and to avoid being seen as rebellious. Number seven, the enthusiast is always on the go, seeking fun. The enthusiast has a compulsive need to be happy, plan fun things, contribute to the world, and to avoid suffering and pain. That's a driver for them. Again, these are going to kind of highlight some motivations that you didn't or weren't aware of in other people. Number eight, the leader. The leader is strong and in control. The leader has a compulsive need to be strong and self-reliant, to make an impact on the world, and to avoid being weak. Now think about how that would impact you in terms of being in a relationship with this type of person or any of the other Enneagrams that I've talked about. Got to know which one you're also going to be able to tolerate being around. Do you think two leaders can really handle it? I think the only reason that Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton have not divorced yet is because they're busy enough with the rest of their other lives. They're never going to get divorced because they're a political couple, right? But they're both leaders. That's got to rub each other raw. And finally, number nine is the peacemaker. The peacemaker strives to bring harmony into the world. The peacemaker has a compulsive need to keep the peace, merge with others, and avoid conflict. Very straightforward. And you can tell what their driving motivation is. Those are nine motivations that are inherent in people. And you can tell what moves that person. Again, a way of determining the prime mover. You want to find the prime mover, and you want to find the secondary movers. That's the Enneagram. I'm going to finish up with what I consider to be probably the simplest and most user-friendly way of typing people of all time. It's the Big Five. The Big Five is known as OCEAN, and those letters stand for the five types, O, C, E, A, and N. Here's OCEAN. Openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, neuroticism. Okay, OCEAN. Openness. Let's talk about openness really quickly. Again, I'm not going to go through all the detail here. I just want to show you what you've got. Openness is a measure of inventive, curious versus consistent or cautious. Think about it as an appreciation for art, emotion, adventure, unusual ideas. Okay? So openness is a rating. You can think of a woman on a spectrum of how open she is. Conscientiousness. Efficient and organized versus easygoing and careless. Does that sound familiar to you? It should. It should sound like the judging from the four in the Myers-Briggs typing, the judging and perceiving. And conscientiousness is a tendency to show self-discipline, act dutifully, and aim for achievement. Oops, move that back over. Against measures or outside expectations. The trait shows a preference for planned rather than spontaneous behavior. That's the best way it can be summed up. I'm going to close it right there. Planned versus spontaneous behavior. And I don't like the wording on that. Conscientiousness doesn't seem to relate to that very well. That's the one thing I would take issue with. Extroversion, again, comes very close to Myers-Briggs, doesn't it? Outgoing and energetic versus solitary and reserved. Okay? It's the energy level. Extroversion is characterized by positive emotions, surgency, and the tendency to seek out stimulation in the company of others. Whereas introverts, much more the other way. I'll leave that reference for you. The sample extroversion items here, you can read these, and if you can relate to them, they will tell you where you stand. The reversed mean that if you agree with that statement, it means that you're not as extroverted. In other words, if you agree with that one, I keep in the background, it really means you're more introverted. That's what reversed means. Agreeableness, the agreeableness factor. Are you an agreeable person? This is friendly and compassionate versus cold and unkind, a tendency to be compassionate and cooperative rather than suspicious and antagonistic. Agreeableness is a tendency to be compassionate and cooperative rather than suspicious and antagonistic towards others. Now, every one of these traits is something I encourage you to sit down and really look at, not only in yourself, but in the woman that you want in your life, and the women you've had in your life that you've either had good relationships with or bad relationships. That's what I want you to come away from this personality typing discussion with, is an exercise where you're going to go back and do a little bit of analysis. First of all, take a personality test. All right, I'm jumping ahead a little bit here before I complete up with neuroticism, but I want this to be really well understood. You must figure out your own typing first. Figure out your desired type, see how it relates to who you are, and then look back and figure out how many women fit either the type that you think you want or have met other types and how that interacted with you. Okay? You can do that in almost any order there, but I encourage you to start with yourself. You're going to see a dynamic relationship there. They're going to see common threads because I've tried different personality types and I have learned distinctively exactly what it is I can and cannot work with. Let's finish up with neuroticism here. Neuroticism is the sensitive, let me adjust that over, sensitive and nervous versus secure and confident. A tendency to experience unpleasant emotions easily, such as anger, anxiety, depression, or vulnerability. In other words, the neurotic level that a woman has is how quickly they're willing to jump into those unpleasant emotions. Neuroticism is a tendency to experience negative emotions, such as anger, anxiety, or depression. It's sometimes called emotional instability. All right, those who score high in neuroticism are emotionally reactive and vulnerable to stress. There's a whole ton of other things in here about this. And I encourage you highly, of all these criteria in OCEAN, I encourage you to really look at that neuroticism one and be very clear about it. That the higher level of neuroticism a woman has, the more turmoil and tumultuousness you'll have in your relationship. And at the same time, a lot more heartache and a lot more angst. You'll have a lot more emotionality to it. It'll seem like a very dynamic relationship in a lot of ways, but it may be more headache than you're willing to work with. I know it is for me. Finally, women consistently report higher neuroticism and agreeableness, and men often report higher extroversion and conscientiousness. Remember conscientiousness, what that was? Efficient and organized versus easygoing and careless. You can see why, right? So men typically have these two, and women really score higher on these two, neuroticism and agreeableness. Openness is probably an open door, could be either. Very important to know, because women are going to be in those two spectrums, and you've got to know how to type and classify them quickly in your head, and it's not hard to do. Simple questions will tell you that, and most of the time, they will tell you simply by the choices they make. Very, very simple, very easy to read. All right, so there's a lot of detailed information there. I want you to go back and read that at a later time. Not important right now. If you want to go in, back into your notes and delve in, that's fine. You can do a deep dive in this topic right now because there's a lot of depth in there. I'm not even hinting at in this video because I want you to explore. I've gone through Myers-Briggs, Enneagram, and Big Five, and you're more than welcome to get all the detail you like out of those two. But follow through with the exercise. I want you to personality type yourself. If you have to take one online or just figure it out on your own, that's fine. Figure out the women in your life, the ones you've had and the one that you want, and figure out where they should be on those scales, and then figure out how it relates back to you. Is it a clash? Is it a fit? It's up to you to determine, okay? We're not doing a big relationship thing here, but it is going to tell you quite a bit about your effectiveness and sexual power with women. That's it for supernatural influence. I bet you didn't think it was going to be that big, huh? We're coming back next with the female typology, where we're going to go into, whoa! A lot of good stuff. We're going to talk about the breakdown of women's psychology and what to look for and how to handle it. Come on back for that. All right, we're going to cover the female typology. What is the female typology? Well, the purpose behind this section, and I want to make sure this is really clear, understanding sexual psychology is mostly about understanding, well, a little bit of your sexual psychology, of course, what drives and motivates you, but hey, we all know, we're guys, we're horny, right? Am I right or am I right? But women, that's another thing, right? We understand how we work, and it's very simple and pretty much cut and dry. But for women, it's a much more complicated process, and we want to understand the psychological process of becoming sexually engaged or sexually attracted and ready for sex. So when we get to the female typology, which is what we're on right now, we're really talking about how to understand women well enough that we can differentiate and treat women differently, so we understand what woman needs what kind of treatment to become sexual, because not all women have the exact same triggers. There are some generic triggers, and there's some very simplified models that we can apply across the board, but on the whole, we have to treat women differently depending on the type of woman. So we're going to be able to type them fairly quickly and easily. Now, the female typology. First of all, we got some ground rules and a guide here. Women are, of course, not one-dimensional. And I know this goes without saying, but again, it's one of those caveats I got to throw in, especially if there's ladies viewing that are going to be like, Carlos is trying to apply this across the board. No, the reason I'm giving you a typology is because women are not one-dimensional. There's no Harry Potter sorting hat where you can just throw her name in the hat and she'll tell you exactly what house she goes to, you know, for you Harry Potter fans out there, or which type of woman she is. You've got to really be able to think outside of the box too. So even as we type a woman into one of these categories, you've also got to be able to see that there's parts of her that will fit into other categories, and recognizing the nuances and not treating them too generically. I got into this discussion with some people in a high-level mastermind that I attend, where we talked about the old shit sandwich rule, which is when you give somebody feedback or constructive feedback, you start out with a compliment or some kind of acknowledgement, something positive, and then you give them the critique or the feedback, and then you go back to, again, something positive, so that the bad thing that you're telling them about is in between two good things. Hence the name shit sandwich. Well, we talked about that, and the fact that the real problem with that model is not that there's anything wrong with it, it's that everybody uses that and they don't use any kind of creative or critical thinking to apply it to individuals. In other words, not everybody's the same. Not everybody will respond to that kind of feedback mechanism. It's good for some people. Other people in other situations, it may not. So recognize that there's certain things you just have to adapt to a particular person. Put in the creative thought. Put in the effort instead of just trying to blandly apply a blueprint, and you'll get much more success. Every single guru has made this one huge mistake, okay? They give you their type, which is the who. They talk about the women in terms of different types. And this is what's very, very distinctive about this program and the thing I want to tell you about, which is they don't give you their when they talk about women. There's the who, their identity, and you know who and what they are, but they don't talk about the when. The when is a critical factor. You have to know the when factor. The when factor is something having to do with when she is in her life, in this particular place in her life. She may be in a particular situation after a breakup, after a life change, after a job change. Her when changes literally every day, if not every hour. So you have to know that when. And again, it's something that most guys don't teach you. I will. All right, now, using natural sort by traits. I'm going to talk about this a little bit. The sort by traits are how a lot of us work, and I'm going to bring in a little bit of NLP in here, and of course NLP is very valid across the board, but I'm not going to try and throw too much at you. I want to give you the essential parts. Perceptional filters is what this is called. Okay, we have natural traits that we use to sort things in our head. Okay, when I figure stuff out, and this goes back to when I first started school, and everybody, when they first started school, we started developing these little mechanisms in our head to help us figure the world out. These are our sort by or perceptional filters that we use to figure things out. Here they are, the four big ones. The first is from and towards. We are either motivated to go from or from something or away from something. I should say kind of away from, but they say from. I'm pushing away from that, or I'm moving towards, meaning I'm gravitating towards something. It's the old carrot and the stick, right? We're either moving away from something we don't want, or we're moving towards something we do want. Sometimes we can engage both of those, and when you can do that, you've got a complete motivational picture. Now, again, when it comes to from and towards, it's, again, oversimplified. It depends on the situation. Sometimes I move away from negative results depending on what those are. In some cases, I'm moving towards without thinking about the moving away from, like fitness, for example. I'm never moving away from being fat because I'm just not a fat guy. I don't have the build for it. I'm always going to be thin. But at the same time, I'm moving towards my goal of being more fit, more having more endurance, having more strength, having more dexterity and core fitness. So you can see where my motivation is there. When it comes to fitness, I'm definitely a towards guy. But in other factors, I'm moving away from guy, perhaps. You know, when it comes from clutter, I'll give you an example there. When my house is dirty and cluttered, Can't stand it. So I'm cleaning it to avoid the clutter. That's why, that's the away from that I'm moving in my life when it comes to my house. The next sort is internal versus external. Do you sort your world or use your perceptual filter based on internal references or external references? Is this stuff that's outside of you, how people are reacting, what's going on around you, or is it in your head where you're like, you're figuring it out here and you're making the decision and that becomes your filter? I'm very much an internal guy. A lot of guys are external. A lot of women are external too. So it depends on the person. You got to look at them. Shy people, very introverted and withdrawn people tend to be much more internal, but they can also be external in situations like social situations where they're looking for the reactions of other people to help them gauge their shyness or their willingness to engage. Are you a details person or a big picture person? Do you attend to the fine, small, granular stuff or the big picture, the I gotta see it all first? I'm a little bit of both. I need to see the big picture first, but then I want to go right down into the details when it comes to actual execution. Match or mismatch? When something new comes into your life, do you match it to something you already experienced, something you already know, or do you compare it as being not like that in some way? This is another one that's very interesting. And again, it works on the fact that we're going to use this in different situations all the time, matching or mismatching. Are we going to be making it like something we already know or unlike something that we know? We compare it to it. So with match and mismatch, you're trying to connect the dots between something that's very common to your experience, something you already experienced before, or against something, or not like something. And I'll give you a perfect example of this, and it's learning a new language. For me, I have to have both, right? I have to have match and mismatch. If I'm learning the word, I'm trying to think of a good one. A good example would be something, because I've been learning Italian in several ways. Here's one that's really, really weird. The word for sleep, right? Dormire, or to sleep, dormire, is, how would you possibly make that something you could remember so that you'd know that that was what it was? Well, the way I do it is to make it like something. It has to be like something. So I'm thinking dorm. It's like dorm, like sleeping in a dorm. There's my memory hook so that I remember what that word is. Now I could just as easily make it different in some other way, and I'm not exactly sure how somebody who has a mismatch kind of sort or filter would do that, but you understand that's the difference between me and somebody else. We would just do it slightly different ways. Okay, so those are the perceptual filters, and the reason I'm bringing these are from NLP, and again, they're very, very effective and help you really figure out people's personalities really well, because you can tell what somebody's going to gravitate to, right? If they're a moving towards person, you're not going to motivate them by pointing out the bad situation they're in so much as you will pointing out the good situation that lies at the end of the road for them. I wouldn't motivate one of my assistants by saying, who has a moving towards thing, by saying, look, you know what, I can't give you as many hours this week if you don't get this thing done. That's not going to be as motivating. In fact, it'll probably piss her off. But if I say, you know what, I've got some really cool tasks for you. If you can get this one done, we can get on to those good ones. And she'll be more motivated to do that, right? That's how you use that understanding and knowledge to get somebody motivated. And again, it's influence. It's persuasion. Now, no absolutes. There are only spectrums here, all right? You can't just say somebody is, like going back to these sort by traits, I can't just say they're absolutely a from person. They're going to be more biased towards being a moving away from person, or they might be more biased towards being an internal reference person. But everybody is going to fit within a spectrum on that scale. Nobody is absolutely external or absolutely internal or absolutely big picture or absolutely details. We have an inclination, and that kind of swings us much more, much further over to that side of the spectrum. There will be exception behaviors that will fly in the face of your read. When I say read, what I mean is your read of their personality. So when we're talking about women, there are going to be exceptions that are going to come up. And you got to watch out for those exceptions and not be thrown by them. It can't freak you out. It can't be like, oh my God, that means that they're really not a moving away from person. No, it might mean that only in that situation they're not. You have to learn the discretion, the critical thinking to figure that out. It's not difficult. All right, so the who factors. We're going to talk about the who and the when and then the modality factors. The who factors you need to understand. First of all, this is my three criteria typing. I'm keeping this super simple for you because it's all you really need to know in order to engage with a woman up front. as you go down the road of getting to know a woman, getting more intimate with her, there's going to be a lot more detail in this picture, a lot more. It's kind of like a paint-by-numbers thing. It's going to get more and more nuanced as you go. Up front, we're going to look for a very quick and simple scheme or mechanism, if you will, that you can figure out quickly. But please, don't think by all means this is going to totally type that person right up front. It's not. It's going to get you everything you really need to do and know up front, but at the same time, you've got to be willing to paint that picture in much more complete colors. A or W. Against or with. And this is based upon, or it's a combination of really, the from and towards, and the match and mismatch. This is specific to women, okay? You're thinking, is this woman an against woman, or is she a with woman? Think about this. Does she flow with you, or is she more of a contrarian? Flowing with you means she's, you know, kind of going with the flow. She doesn't really disagree with you very much. She's always looking for reasons to go, yeah, totally, uh-huh. You know, the contrarian girl, on the other hand, is going to be much more inclined to be like, what? No way. No. Uh-uh. You know, she's more of the, I'm going to play with you. I'm going to mess with you. She's going to basically yank your chain a lot more. She's going to be a lot more confrontational. She's got a much significantly reduced fear of confrontation. So she's going to be on that part of the spectrum. Is she focused on goals or problems and drama? This is a big one because this is actually a personality thing for me. I am much more attracted to the with women. I love the against women too because they give me a little bit of a challenge. But the with women, the ones that are more with you, with the path that you're on, with your energy flowing with it, they're going to be a long-term catch as far as I'm concerned. The against women give you a lot of dynamic energy and they can be very good for being the devil's advocate, challenging you on things. But they can also be a real pain in the ass, quite honestly. And that's not something I'm not that into. For some guys, the against works with them much better because they have the type of personality that fits into really well. Kind of like really perfect fit Lego blocks. Not for me. I'm much more of a with guy. So again, is she focused on goals and positively working towards things, or is she looking more at the problems or the drama or the trauma of a situation than anything else? That's one of the ways you can figure this girl out. It's very easy to figure this one out, by the way. Just really just observing her in the first few minutes of interactions is good. Again, keep these things in mind that when we talk about how to type a woman, we're talking about normal circumstances and normal conversation. When you're in a bar or a club environment, this is not so normal. This is not so, it's not the same thing. It really isn't. It's a different kind of environment. So recognize that personality traits can be distorted and modified just by virtue of being out under the influence of alcohol in a higher energy environment, around a lot of other attention-seeking guys and attention-seeking women. It's a different environment. In a lot of ways, it's actually kind of a false or artificial environment too. Okay, so that's the A or W. I'm going to leave that open while we go into the P or the D. The P or D in a particular category is the practical or the dreamer. Is she a practical or is she a dreamer? A practical girl is grounded, okay? She's more inclined to the provider type of guy. She's a practical girl, right? She's got to meet her needs. She's goal-driven. She's a thinker. She's a little bit more intellectual. Job that she has, the job she's in, is a career. She's not as emotionally connected to it, okay? It's not a passion for her. She'll often deny the male-female gender roles. This is one of the big clues that you're talking to a practical girl. And she can also be a feminist or have feminist leanings or be in that mode of being much more geared towards feminist-type behaviors and thinking. She's probably career-focused. The family is often further out in the future for her. She's not as geared or doesn't seem to be as geared towards having kids right away. And she's probably just talking about it like, yeah, you know what? I might not have to have kids. I mean, this will probably change for her later on. I'm giving you that warning right up front. But the reality is that the family for her is not a pressing concern. It just doesn't. You can tell in her emotional state, not even just in her words, but her emotions and her choices, it's just not that big a deal. She's a little bit more career focused. Again, her job is a career. Please don't misunderstand these two as contradicting each other. She's focused on her career, and her job is a career, but she's not as emotionally connected to what she's doing. It's not like a calling. It's something she's really fulfilling as part of a role. That's the practical. The dreamer, on the other hand, The dreamer's a little bit flighty. She's a little bit more woo-woo, if you want to think of it that way. Again, I'm painting these pictures in extremes so you can kind of see the difference and the contrast. She's imaginative. She enjoys the fantasy. This is really important. When you're engaging with this woman, you got to play with the fantasy. If she's willing to go there with you, she's probably more of the dreamer type than the practical. Every woman has parts of her life where she's more practical than dreamer, but this is something you can use. She's much more into the love at first sight ideology or belief system. She can go for that much more. She's more sensual. She's more physical, more grounded in her body. She usually understands the female and male gender roles much better. Okay, she understands how women and men are supposed to interact, how attraction works between men and women. She likes to be pampered. Quite honestly, she wants to be taken care of. She wants to be treated like a princess in a lot of ways. She may come from money. I've seen this a lot with these girls, is that they've been liberated from all the things about having to be practical. They didn't have to go out and get a job right away or, you know, get her degree. Even if she did get it, she didn't have to go out and work. She was pretty much in a safe spot, or she came from an environment where it didn't feel as pressing. Well, she might come from money. She has an emotional connection to her career. She's much more emotionally involved and engaged. She may be a social worker. She might be an artist. She might be somebody that's working in a more creative line of thinking and line of work for maybe advertising or something like that. But she's much more, I think, right brain than left brain. She's also much easier to get with the bad boy set of values and set of behaviors. Whereas the practical was much more into she's much more inclined towards the providers. And that's not to say you couldn't seduce a practical girl with the bad boy. She's in that mode of thinking. But it's going to be easier for the bad boy to get into a dreamer's head and get her into that space of really being attracted to. Family focused. A dreamer is focused on the family, and she does have a clear plan for eventually having children, having kids in the near future, you know, whatever it is. She definitely still has a vision of that family. Even if it's not immediate, it's still there and it's very concrete for her. It's a possibility, if not a definite requirement in her life. So there you go. The P or D is practical or dreamer. All right, and I think you see the difference between those two when you're trying to type women. So we've covered A or W, against or with, and practical or dreamer. Oh, and just a little add-on here for the practical or dreamer. Sometimes the practical dreamer dichotomy is thought of as the brain versus the emotions. Okay, it's not always true. It doesn't always align that, you know, the practical is the brain thinker and the dreamer is the emotion thinker, but they do actually roughly correspond to the sides of their brain that they're most engaged with. The unfortunate thing is, from what I understand, I think it's a very, very high percentage. I think it may be up to 80% of Americans today have what we call left brain leanings, meaning they're much more logical, practical, and we're losing a lot of this dreamer. And when you can come across as a dreamer to a dreamer, and sometimes correctly a dreamer to a practical, really, really effective. And depending on the when, you being a practical to a dreamer might make the most sense. She might be in a dreamy mode where she's disillusioned about where she is in life and she's feeling lost, and you can tell that her psychological state is a little uncertain, maybe slightly unstable. A practical who comes to her in that state is going to have a much better grounding, a better feel or vibe to her, because it's going to give her the rooting and the foundation she needs to feel safe and secure. So there's different timings to be considered for each one of these people. And for the practical dreamer, does she rationalize or does she see her emotions and then flow with them? Think about that. Does she rationalize situations and you know, make them work according to some logic, arcane as it may be? Or does she see her emotions and recognize them and just flow with them? Those are another two ways of thinking about that particular breakdown. Okay, last one, the third one, I or E. Internal, external. Very close again to the internal external from when we talked about the NLP factors, right? Internal external. This one's a little bit more broad in scope because we're talking about women, because we're talking about a very initial, fast, upfront understanding of her personality type. Internal has a strong belief system and strong leadership capability. External can also have those, but she's also much more focused on the external factors. Okay, so what's your validation mechanism? Okay, these are the two factors that build into I or E. Make this very simple for you. Validation mechanisms: self or others. How do they judge the world? And you can think of judge as in how the judging perceiving one worked when we talked about Myers-Briggs, right? Do they validate things by internal reference, or do they look to other people to help kind of gain a consensus, if you will, with their own opinion? Their opinions might not seem, if they're an external, their own opinions might not seem as strong. They may have to check in with other people frequently. You know, a woman that constantly asks you, am I crazy? Is that weird? You know, somebody that like that might be very externally driven. An internal is going to have her own set of beliefs, and she's going to already have her direction in a lot of ways. And there's also a connection to the introvert-extrovert. Where is she getting her energy from? All right? They may or may not coincide. Sometimes you may have somebody that's a very strong introvert who is, you know, looking for judgment and getting a lot of external validation. It happens from time to time. It's a small sliver. But on the whole, you're looking to answer this question. Is she an internal person living internally in her head a little bit more? Is she internally validated? Is she shyer, kind of withdrawn internally? Or is she much more external, more vocal, more consensus-seeking, more social, more outward? That's the primary drive in this girl. I or E. All right. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on them because they're very, very simple. It's very easy to figure out those three fairly quickly, and it will give you a strategy for going forward with sexual attraction and sexual communication, which is what we're going to be talking about coming up. So again, the two types, against or with, three types rather, against or with, P or D is practical or dreamer, and the I or E is internal or external. That's it. That's all you need. And what are the combinations here? 2 times 2 is 4, times 2 is 8. 8 possible types of women given all of these categories. And you're going to find a lot of them are kind of grouped up or clumped up pretty close. You're going to find a lot of against girls tend to be practical or internal in a lot of ways. You could also see that there's a lot of against girls that are external. The dreamer girls tend to be a little bit more internal because they've lived a much more strong internal life, but that doesn't mean that they can't be an external dreamer at the same time. So yeah, you're going to have to figure out the categories, and you can do it fairly quickly just based on the criteria I gave you there. All right, the who factors, ARW, PRD, IRE. Now, what is the other big mitigating factor that most people don't take into consideration? It's the when. All right, what are the when factors? Here are the types. Uncertain or certain. That's all you need in this one. Is the uncertainty or certainty of where she is right now. It's kind of like the stability that she's feeling at that given moment. Is she certain about where she is, or is she uncertain about where she is? Uncertainty is equivalent roughly to unstable. Certain is stable. That when is going to give you a certain clue into the who. When I'm looking at a woman that's a dreamer, if she's an unstable dreamer, meaning that things are unstable for her right now, that's when I'm telling you, you're probably going to have to go in as a practical guy to her, okay? But if she's a stable dreamer, if she's really feeling good about the vibe she's in and the world, and I'm thinking, of course, I live in San Francisco. This is the mecca for dreamers in a lot of ways. It's funny that the new agey mindset just inhabits everything here sometimes. If you come into a dreamer who's in her stable time period, you're better off probably coming in as another dreamer, because a practical guy is going to seem like she's not going to be able to relate, because she's already feeling good about where she is on her dreamer path. All right. And I can go through these combinations in graphic detail, but you're going to figure them out pretty intuitively. It's not very difficult. Number one, there's different also breakdowns of these two times. I'm going to give a little bit more detail on each one. There's the unstable who has lost a connection of some kind. This is dealing particularly with women. There's all sorts of unstable situations and conditions, but by and large, the unstable in the lost connection type is somebody, a woman, who's lost a connection of some kind. She's shaken up by the loss of a friendship or the perceived possible loss of a friendship or close connection she has with another individual. Could be a boyfriend. Could be a close friend. Could be somebody in her family. It could be somebody that died. Could be a family member that died or somebody important in her life that's moved away. Whatever the case may be, she's feeling a lost connection. There's an unstable who's in the state of change. This is a transitional woman. She's going from one phase to another, and even though she may see both sides of it, she's in the motion between the two, and that leaves her feeling a little shaky. It's kind of like jumping between two stable platforms. When you're in the air, it's kind of like, whoa, it's a weird feeling. And then there's unstable, who's in drama right now. This is a woman who's either emotionally upset about something, or maybe one of her connections is threatened. Okay, maybe it's not an actual loss connection, but she's feeling the threat of loss. And there's drama in her life. There's some kind of emotional turmoil going on, and that lends a sense of instability. Now, overall, she could be a person that's in a certain or stable state and feeling a little unstable, but still, overall, she's stable, right? She might have a threatened relationship, but she's dealing with it and she has confidence in it, so it hasn't shaken her up totally. You're looking for the big picture, uncertain or certain, and then figuring out why that person might be uncertain. Is it because of the lost connection in her life? Is it because of a change? Or is there some emotional drama that she's contending with? Number two, certainty, stability. Not a lot you need to do there, honestly. I mean, I would recommend you probe and find out what gives her that sense of foundation and sense of security. I would definitely go there with this particular woman, but you'll be able to sense that things are good, things are stable. She doesn't seem to be a little too weird or emotional or in any kind of turmoil. That's a great place to be. And again, it relates back to these other states. If she's an unstable, let me give you another example here because I know this needs a little bit more explaining. If she's an uncertain or unstable internal person, what is her likely behavior going to be? Probably to draw back in again. She's going to become shyer. She's going to become more withdrawn and much more attuned to herself to regain her stability. An external who is in an unstable time period, what is she going to do? She's going to be seeking a lot more consensus, a lot more validation, a lot more connection outside of herself. I've found that women that are in an unstable state, but they're externally biased, tend to be much more difficult in some ways to seduce because they're not set with any one particular person. They're looking for a whole bunch of people to give them their sense of grounding. But again, this is all variable. It depends on the situation. This is not cookie cutter stuff necessarily. So there you go. That's it. That's the simplified model of being able to type a woman. It's not difficult at all. You're against or with, practical or dreamer, internal or external. For the timing factors that you have to consider with all three of against, with, practical, dreamer, internal, external, you have to consider that they have to be in an either unstable, uncertain state or a certain and stable state. One more example before we go and leave this, because I feel like this is actually one of the coolest sections of this class, and I want to make sure you get this. What would be, and I'm going to leave you with this just this thought for a second, what would you do with an uncertain again with person? What would you do with an uncertain with person? They're a person that goes with the energy, but they're uncertain. How would you treat them? How would you handle them? Well, first of all, you know that they're a flowing with you type of person. They're going to be focused more on their goals, their forward direction in life, right? But they're uncertain. So what they would probably use from you is more certainty, that's pretty much a duh, but in the areas that make the most sense for them, that where they're going and where they're going with the positive motion that they're in, they're probably stalled. They're probably in a state of hesitation or non-action, and they want to get moving forward again. So to remove that blockade, you have to give them certainty, which will move them forward. And if you can paint that picture for that type of person, the with type of woman, you're going to unlock doors for her. You're going to seem like her personal guru. I've done this a lot with women. With an against woman, who's normally against and kind of likes to be contrarian, if she's uncertain, what are you going to do there? Well, she's probably going to be a little bit more dug in. She's going to be a little bit more, she's grounded in her against behavior because it gives her a feeling of me versus the world. And when she's uncertain, it's going to shake that a little bit. It's going to be a little bit flightier. and you need to watch out for that kind of behavior. She may even tend to shift into a little bit of with behavior, but then right back again into against behavior. So she's kind of uncertain enough to hold her own ground, and so she flip-flops between with and against. These two factors, the when, are going to tell you a lot about a person, because it's going to give you an understanding of why they may be behaving a little bit uncertain, a little bit erratic, a little more irrational, especially with women. There you go. Timing and the who. All right, let's finish up this typology really quickly with modality factors. The modality factors, you can bring this into the equation too. These are all things you can sprinkle in, by the way. You don't have to use them all at once. You could use the who factors all on their own. That's totally fine. You can also use the timing factors all on their own. That's fine too, the certainty, uncertainty aspect. It's going to be a little bit weaker if you just use those. But modality factors, let's talk about these. Visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. If you've had any of my programs, you probably know about these three. These are, there's also another one they've talked about called, I think it's called digital or something like that. I don't know. It's where you have a modality of your own thoughts are a sense for you. Let's leave that out of the equation. The primary ones are visual, auditory, and kinesthetic. Now, there's a great book I'm going to encourage you to read, and I'll give it to you as a reference at the end of the class, not to confuse things now, but it talks about how we have all three of these modalities. You have one that's very specific to you in terms of your learning style and how you use the outside world. That's your primary modality. You've probably heard that before, either in NLP or one of my programs or something else. I'm primarily a visual person. Everything is about seeing with me. If the house is cluttered, I feel uncertain inside. It actually translates back into my emotional state. Other people are auditory. They have to hear it to learn it. They have to hear it first. It doesn't sound right to them, or it does sound right to them. They think in terms of sound. And some people are all about the feel. It doesn't feel right with me. They have to feel something. Okay, those are the three modalities, but you also have to understand that we also have, in addition to our primary modality, mine's visual, we have a sorting modality and an unconscious modality. I have an auditory sorting modality and a kinesthetic unconscious modality. Now, I'm not going to go down into details on this because I don't want to make it a big deal. You can do this. It's great for you to figure out your personality type and how you work. But recognize that even though a woman has a particular modality as her primary, which you should be figuring out, is she a visual, is she an auditory, or is she a kinesthetic? You want to figure these out. Good ways of doing it are just listening to her talk, because she'll basically give it away. You know, if she doesn't see eye to eye with you, if she can't see that or see what you're saying, she's a visual. If it doesn't sound right to her, that this sounds weird, probably auditory. You know, it doesn't feel right, feels a little weird, feels odd, that'd be a kinesthetic. But you can also tell these cues from a woman based on how she looks or how she talks and things like that too. Just keep in mind that there's also other modalities that are working beneath the surface that you can also tap into. And I'm going to give you a resource for that later on, because I don't want to make this too complicated. A lot of guys make this stuff way too complicated when it comes to personality typing of women. It's very simple. It's those factors that I gave you, the who factors, the timing factors. And if you want to bring in visual, auditory, or kinesthetic, those are also really simple to figure out on a woman and layer into the model you're using. That's it, the female typology. Wow, that's a big discussion, isn't it? All unto itself. All right, so when we come back in the next section, I'm going to talk about gratification rules and what they are. Gratification rules. When we're talking about sexual psychology, what are gratification rules? Well, these are the rules that we work by that allow us to feel like we've accomplished something, or that we're gratified, or that we've satiated ourselves, right? There's pain and pleasure are the primary gratification rules that we all work on. Pain. I consider pain to be 100% more motivating than pleasure. And for the simple reason that, first of all, it's a moving away. And most people, if I'm understanding this correctly, I believe that most people are moving away in terms of their filter, their perceptual filter that we talked about earlier. We move away towards pain much more readily and much more actively than we do moving towards pleasure. When we're in pain, all of our other motivations just shut down because we're in pain. Your body, your mind, you're totally constructed to be a pain avoidance mechanism. So we seek to avoid, move away from pain at all costs. Even if it hasn't been experienced yet, if we think it's coming, we're going to try to avoid it. We become blind to any kind of rational thinking when we're in pain, right? And the big pain we're thinking of course, is the pain of not having any sex. That is a real, legitimate pain, because sex is a primary drive, a primary motivation for human beings. You may be familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where they talk about, you know, you have this base need for food and water and shelter. And then on top of that, all these other needs are layered on top. And sexual, having sex and procreation is right there, right after the whole needing food and shelter and water. Up at the top of that pyramid, after you've got all those other things done, that's where actualization, self-growth comes in. And the unfortunate thing is, for a lot of guys right now, in order to get that sex they desire so much, they have to jump to the top of the pyramid. This is a big revelation if you think about it. Maslow's hierarchy of needs says that you can't get to those higher levels on the pyramid until you get those other levels taken care of, because you're too, like, if I'm starving right now, I really could give a shit about how, you know, what kind of self-growth class I'm going to be going into next week. I got to feed myself. I got to survive. Survival comes first. And then, considering that sexuality and the ability to have sex and sexual connection and that emotional connection that we have with people is also a very basic need and comes right after that, you know, how do I get to the point where I get that stuff when I need to go right to the top of the pyramid and start figuring these things out and learning them as skills? It's a difficult jump to make, to jump to the top to get to the lower layers. And this is why you have to find ways to kind of satiate those needs, to get yourself gratified before you can get to the levels of learning. Okay, a really important distinction here for you guys to understand this. It's going to be a big aha for you. You got to be able, if you're in a constant state of pain, you're not going to be able to see, because you're blind to rational thinking, you're not going to be able to see the things you need to see. Okay, pleasure. How does the pleasure principle work? Well, it motivates, but it's not as strong as pain is, of course. Pleasure motivates us. That's a moving towards value, but it does not motivate us nearly as much as pain does. The result is this. If you give a woman a result she wants, she's going to feel value from you. Okay, I'm turning this pain-pleasure principle and gratification rule around in a way that you can leverage for more connection with women. If you can give a woman a result that she's looking for, whatever it may be, whether it's a realization, whether it's a fun interaction with her, whatever it may be, she's going to feel that there's value in that interaction. This is how you communicate value to a woman, by not being focused on being higher value. Okay, a lot of gurus, a lot of seduction experts are constantly telling you to be a higher value guy. There is some validity to that, but unfortunately, it's become way too big a focus for most guys. You want to communicate value to a woman by giving her results she's looking for, where she can feel the value. If she just sees a guy that is quote-unquote higher value, yeah, there's some attraction there, some desire, but it's not real for her. In other words, the second you're out of her sight, she can forget about you and there's no value anymore. The value she feels, she now can move towards and understand. Not getting that value becomes pain that she will experience. The pain of withdrawal, the pain of you not being there. I hope you understand that difference. That's really distinct too. Oh, and all other value that you fake will not work nearly as well as giving her that value. Let's go to that example, a gas station, okay? The normal price for 1 gallon of gas, let's say, is $3.50. God knows when you're watching this, it could be $10. Who knows? But the normal price for a gallon of gas is $3.50. Now, I give somebody an offer, number one. I'm trying to market my gas station, and I want to give somebody a special offer so they come and get my gas. And I say, you know what? Come on into my gas station, and I will give you 10 gallons of gas for $31.50. Okay, well, they work out the math. And they can figure out that, okay, $10 or 10 gallons times 350, that's $35. Subtract 31.50, that's $3.50 I'm saving. You know, they have no real obligation to take you up on that. There's nothing that really makes it urgent and doesn't make it very interesting for them. It's like, okay, I'm getting a little discount, $3.50, big deal. Let me give you special offer number two in contrast. My gas station, I'm going to market this way. 1 gallon free. No strings attached. Come on into my gas station. You can get 1 gallon of gas for absolutely nothing. Who wouldn't take me up on that, right? Who wouldn't come in and say, wow, a free gallon of gas? No problem. I mean, yeah, it's not much, but it's a free gallon of gas. I'm going in and doing that. How many people would take you up on that fill up? Ask yourself, how many people do you think would take you up on that? I think quite a few, because once you drive into a gas station and you put that thing, that hose in your gas tank, you're not stopping at 1 gallon. You're going to keep going. You see where I'm going with this? Based on the reciprocity alone, you're going to get a much higher take rate. Many more people are going to come into your gas station and want your gas because, I mean, the free gallon is a lure in itself, which is great, but they're not going to stop at 1 gallon. They're going to fill up the tank. Forget about the fact that your hose is in their tank. Excuse me on that one. You know what I mean, right? You're already in there. You already got them taking your gas. Which one of those offers makes the most sense to you? Okay, I think it should be very clear that the 1 gallon free is the much better offer. This is how value works in a person's mind. What they get, the initial investment, the upfront thing they get and take away from you, is going to be the thing that feels most valuable and will want them to come back for more. This is just a declaration of higher value, but it doesn't have any real bite to it. Yeah, sure, it's 10 gallons for $31.50. There's a discount there. It's a better value. So what? Even if I said 10 gallons for, honestly, if I said 10 gallons for $28, you'd be like, okay, so it's like $5, $6, I don't know, something like that, $6 off, whatever. It's still not very enticing. Yeah, there's a discount there. But when I say 1 gallon free with no strings, totally different offer, isn't it? You need to be the person out there giving 1 gallon free to every woman. Do you think she would turn you down for a fill up? I'm going to leave the sexual analogy right where that one ended. Okay, so you get the idea here, right? The pain versus pleasure principle and how to truly motivate women with sexual attraction. I hope that example there, the gas station example, made it clear for you. Sexual keystones. The sexual keystones are chemistry and safety. These are the linchpins, these are the anchor points, if you will, on how to create sexual attraction with women. Chemistry and safety. Chemistry is attraction and rapport, okay? It's attraction and rapport. Attraction is that feeling of, ooh, I like that, I want that. Rapport is a sense of, I can connect with them. It's not normally thought of as attraction, but think about this. Being able to connect with someone creates a bridge between safety and chemistry. That's what rapport is about in a lot of ways. Rapport is a way of creating a sense of connection between the safety factor and the chemistry factor in women, in their minds, when you're trying to connect with them. And it's important for that reason. Of course you want chemistry with a woman, but you also have to have the safety, and if you can connect the two using rapport and connection, dude, you're gold. Safety, being protective. In other words, being protective without being controlling. You can provide a safe situation for a woman, a safe a feeling of safety around a woman, a safe bubble, safe zone, if you will, but doing it without being controlling or dominating, right? We're talking about, in this course, about being the dominant man, but you don't need to be dominating to be dominant. Now, when a woman resists your protection, I want to caution you here because a lot of guys run into this. When it comes to chemistry and safety, when a woman resists your protection or literally refuses that feeling of safety that you're trying to give her, there's a problem there. That's a red flag. I'll give you an example of this. One of the ways that men do that safety thing is through chivalrous behavior, opening doors for women. Now, whether you realize it or not, opening the door for a woman is kind of a safety thing, okay? It's got elements of safety in it and protection. That's really what it's about in a lot of ways. It's not only courtesy, but it's also safety and protection. Some women get a little bit uppity about that. They like run up to the door and open it themselves. I've seen this. I've seen it quite a bit. These are women that have issues with their sexuality, and I want to caution you to watch out for that. So you got to be protective. You got to give her that safe zone, as well as give her the chemistry, the feeling of, ooh, oh, there's something there. The two are not in conflict. The two are complementary. Those are the keystones of all sexual communication and sexual attraction. Again, we're going down the road here, so this is going to be a little bit further down the road to get there. To get action out of a person, pain. Typically, pain is the way to get it, and I hate to say this in this kind of term, but pain plus urgency plus the possibility of pleasurable result, okay? This is how you get somebody to do something, is give them pain plus urgency plus the possibility of a pleasurable result. It's kind of the universal equation that helps somebody take action. That's how we take action. If we perceive there's pain coming up the road, and guess what? I can no longer avoid it. I got to do something about it. And then I add in, hey, you know what? It's possible that if I take care of this business, I'm going to feel a whole lot better, and there's going to be pleasure at the end of this situation. I'm going to have a complete picture for getting myself motivated to do something. Pain is sometimes the potential loss of pleasure once they've gained it. So for that woman who came into your gas station to fill up with a free gallon of gas, you know, the potential loss of not filling up the rest of the tank or not getting her, you know, like you come out and you offer to clean her windshield or you offer to check the air in her tires, the old school method of gas stations. Pain is sometimes the potential loss of pleasure once they've gained it. Now, I want to caution here because this is bordering on manipulative behavior. If I come up to a woman and I give her a fun time and then I take away that fun, that's a way to motivate a person, but it's also possibly manipulative. Like, I'm going to take away your toy and I'm going to ground you, right? I'm going to take away this fun thing that you're having and fun time that you're having, and you're grounded. That becomes punishment. Be careful about that. Because the pain then becomes associated with the person that we feel is responsible for it. I've seen guys do this in relationships where they're fun with a woman, they have fun with women, but at the first sign that she's doing something he doesn't like, what does he do? He takes away her toys. He takes away the fun. He basically controls through manipulation this way. It's kind of tyrannical behavior. And then what happens is she builds up resentment in her. The pain is now associated, that she feels is associated with that person that she thinks is taking her toys away from her. And just make it simply implied with your attitude. You don't actually take away their toy. You make it implied that, you know what, if we're not hanging out with each other, you're not getting this, and you might not be able to hang out with me, so what do you think? You're not really doing it as a carrot or a stick. You're just, it's always the potential, right? You want to hang out with a woman because of the good feeling she's going to give to you and the good situation you're going to be in, the possible sexual situation. There's all these things drawing you into that. The possibility of not having that is painful, and it draws you into different behaviors because of it. All right, enough said on all this motivational stuff. I want to talk about really quickly after sex. I want to tell you that the focus after sex with a woman changes things. After you have sex with a woman, because we're getting to this point now where we're talking about how to close the deal with women, I want to remind you that in psychology, after you get to sex with a woman, the focus is going to change. Things are going to change at this point. If she's a resistor, remember we talked about resistors and non-resistors? If she's a resistor, she has strong resistance, she's going to assume that there's a relationship there. Okay? If she's the type of woman that typically resists sex and tries to hold back from it because she sees it as her power tool, her power over you and her power in the relationship, well, if she gives that up, she's going to assume that there's a relationship here now. She's going to have some sort of established connection. If she's not a resistor, she may, the key word is may, assume nothing. She might assume there's nothing there. And you might have to work to actually get a relationship if you'd like to sleep with her again, okay? The very distinct difference in how those two types of women behave. No matter what, you are obligated as a man to reassure her after sex. Call her the next day. This is simple stuff, okay? This is by the numbers. You call her the next day, no matter what your intentions are, whether they're to sleep with her again or not, you call her the next day just to connect with her. Give her a sense of reassurement, all right? It's a cliche, but it's actually completely true. I'll call you tomorrow. I'll call you later. Do it. Actually do it. Even if you don't want to sleep with her again, just do it. It's not going to obligate you to more sex. It's pretty easy to get out of that. Don't worry. You do need to do this, though, okay? Because you don't want to burn your bridges too many times. A good friend I know had three rules that he went through his life with, and I'll give you these three rules because I think they're pretty good. Number one is don't burn your bridges. Number two is don't bite the hand that feeds you. And number three is don't mistake my kindness for weakness. Pretty good rules. Because the reason you're doing this reconnection, is because she fears the disconnect and the thought of being used. And you don't need to do that to a woman. That's simply not necessary. So that connection, that just that call, is a good way to reconnect. Plus, she might have buyer's remorse. It's an awkward emotional place for a woman. After she's slept with you, she's just given, you know, lowered her defenses. She's let you into her body, possibly into her house, her world, and her life. There's so much risk and so many things that go on with this. You have to understand, this is why women make it sometimes arduous for guys to get where they want to go. She may have buyer's remorse. Okay, you got to understand, this is an awkward emotional place for a woman. She has just let you into her, possibly her apartment, her bed, her body, her mind, her feelings. There's so much vulnerability at this point. She might have buyer's remorse, so you have to understand that there's an awkward emotional place here. She might be thinking, what did I do? Where is this going? There's a broad instinctual anxiety that's going to be raised up when she first has sex with you, whether she wants to admit it or not. She will disconnect first to make a preemptive strike. A lot of women do this. They will disconnect from you, or they'll try and push you away mentally and emotionally just to kind of make it what it was. Okay, so we had sex, whatever. And then later on, she can totally redefine the rules to not make that sex. If you persist, you can usually keep her, even if she does this on you. Okay, it's not a big deal. If a woman tries to disconnect and push you away, it's not because she's just trying to get rid of you, although sometimes it is. The reality is that most women would like to keep the connection going. Whatever you do, please don't proclaim love at this point. You're not in love. This is really important for guys to understand. Love does not equal sex. Sex does not equal love. Although they can later on, and they can actually augment and add to each other, don't proclaim love just for lack of anything better to say. Oh, I think, you know what? I just knew I was in love with you from the first time. No, cut that shit right out there. Don't do that. Okay? Wait. If it's still early on, you need to wait. Again, one of my ground rules is I'm not going to be in love with any woman until at least 3 months in, and that would be, you know, the earliest. So even if I feel it, I'm still going to wait. The number one thing to do after sex, you know what it is? No, it's not throw away the condom. It's eat or drink. It's a great way to end, lock everything up, sew up the loose ends. Eat or drink. It's great. Go get some food, share some food together. It's a great way to reconnect and kind of take away that awkwardness that happens. Don't fall asleep right away. Men have this need to sleep, right? It's a biological thing. You got to fight that. After sex, grab something out of the fridge, have a little food, snack, you know, something that's sexy. Women often feel energized after sex. You got to recognize that you falling asleep seems like a disconnect to them. So the number one thing, just a little clue, a little side thing there. Eat or drink after sex. It's a great thing to do to seal it up. So the after sex might seem like it's like, out of place. I thought we were talking about psychology. It's a psychological factor to consider because of the way women are made up about this. Sexual psychology and sexual desire in women, we're going to finish up here. Sexual desire in women and how women are turned on and how they feel. Being physically turned on is disconnected from her being turned on psychologically. I'm saying this over and over again because it's a really important point for guys to understand. They can get way far in and turn off the lights on you, okay? Totally shut everything down. It means you can stop at any time, even when you can't. So you're going to find points of frustration in there. And you got to recognize, you've got to stay in control of your emotions. Even when you're heightened in your sexual excitement is going to lead you to possibly some emotional reactions. Don't go there. A woman's brain circuits are literally not connected the same way that yours are. She literally does not have a connection between, oh my God, I'm so hot and physically hot right now, and the rest of her brain. It's not connected there. And they've done tests on this, and it's an important thing to understand. Here's another part of a woman's sexual psychology that you need to realize, and this is very basic and very important to know. Men want a woman's desire. We want a woman to want us. We want her wanting us and needing us almost. Women desire only to feel the desire of men. Think about this for a second. Yes, she wants to have the same things you do, but women are more attached to and more connected to and more they see much more vividly another man's desire. This is why women tend to flirt quite a bit more. This is a primary reason that you have to broadcast sexuality in your conversation. She doesn't want to feel intellectual interest. She wants to feel actual desire from men. This is what women are actually clued in on. If you read their romance books, if you read the things that women are drawn to in terms of erotica, they want to feel the desire of men. In general, not a specific man, the desire of men. That's how they validate their existence and sometimes their feelings of self-worth. By demonstrating desire to a woman, Okay, because I just said the primary reason that you have to broadcast sexuality is to give her that feeling of desire. By demonstrating desire, you're going to immediately spark a primal interest from her. It's something she can't control. So when you demonstrate desire for her in the right ways, you're going to be fast forwarding to attraction. Okay, don't do this play it nice guy thing. There's a reason why some of the bad boy stuff really works, going in with a harder edge and a much more, The reason for the dark secret that if you just pursue a woman valiantly, that she will almost always give in eventually, okay? There is this dark secret, and I'm revealing this here now, and that is that if you do persist, if you just chase after a woman enough, and I know you can totally play the nice guy thing in this too, you can still have that woman after a time. You will probably get a shot at her eventually. And I know this goes in the face of everything that all the seduction guys try and teach you, but think about this for a second because this is important. She will probably almost always give in eventually. But will you have the kind of relationship that she's going to stick with? You better be able to go into the right, switch tracks into the right kind of behavior once you've gone there. It's a dark secret. Again, most guys would tell you, no, I mean, you can be the nice guy forever and she's still going to keep you around as an orbiter and a friend. The truth is that eventually she'll probably give in. She'll probably, just by virtue of wanting to feel that desire, she'll give it a shot. But you've got to be able to really change gears when that time comes. So think, persistence of desire. How resilient is your interest in her? Is it passing or is it fleeting? Because if it's strong and it's resilient and it's persistent, she's going to feel it and she's going to know it from the fake stuff. That's really important. A woman knows when your attraction for her is the, I just happen to see you and I think you're attractive, versus, whoa, dude, I'm like totally digging you. You're just like, oh, man. That's a different kind of desire. And when you can communicate it to her, that's when you trigger this instinctual need, the need to feel the desire, the flow of desire from you to her. Really, really big. All right, covered a lot of deep stuff in this particular class. We went through every element of psychology that you really need in terms of women, as well as how to understand them. Wow, take a deep breath, take some time, maybe review this section again, because there's a lot of stuff in here. Then I want you to move on to the sexual roadmap. From there, we're going to go into much more detail about the process of going from just attraction to the bedroom with a woman. We're going to cover, over zoom there, how to elevate your social status and how important that is, handling stepping stones, all the good stuff around what is the actual roadmap, stepping stones from A to Z and going to sleep, to basically sleeping with women. All right, we'll cover that in the next section. Take a little breather though, that was a pretty deep and intense session, and come back for the sexual roadmap. Okay, we're summarizing the sexual psychology. We went through an immense amount of material in this particular part of the program. We did another reality check, of course, that there's no magic or hypnosis involved in this, that alpha sexual power is a technology, and it's the one I'm teaching you here. The prime movers, the motivational aspects of sexual desire and sex itself. I talked about the sexual templates and the myths that we have, the experience of women, so you understand some very, very deep psychological understandings about women and why women behave the way they do. We also went into a lot of typing and understanding of personality types, basically. I call it supernatural influence, when you can understand all these different things using basically sexual kung fu to match a woman's skills. I gave you a simple model of understanding sexuality, as well as going into the resistance factor. When we talk about women, you can type women by their resistance factor. The Myers-Briggs NLP way of reading women and understanding their personalities, as well as the Enneagram and the different typologies there. Also, we talked about the OCEAN, the Big Five method of personality typing with women. Then we went into what I call the female typology. It's my own trademarked way of basically breaking down and understanding women by three simple factors that allows for only six combinations. Those factors depend on who and timing. The who of who she is, those six factors, and then on the, I guess you call it the mitigating factor of timing and how that works in the uncertainty or certainty.
I talked about gratification rules, the pain and pleasure principle, and the results that we're looking to give with the gas station example, which I really encourage you to listen to several times so you understand how it works when you try and motivate people and how you have to look through their eyes. We talked about sexual keystones, how to get action, and then how to handle after sex, a little bit of the psychology of what's happening after sex. So it's probably a little jump ahead in the program, but it was important to paint that because we talked about sexual psychology and sexual desire with women. So there you go. There's a brief summary of the sexual psychology section. This is really important, a lot of deep information here that I want you to use. Definitely the one thing to take away from this section is to use my female typology and use it to figure out as many of the women in your life as you possibly can. Really good way of using it and putting it to use right away without having to actually be worried about doing it correctly in the field, if you will, when you're actually meeting women and approaching women. Use it to type the women that you already know. Figure out what their resistance factor is. Figure out if they're an A or W, an against or with. Figure them out if they're a practical or dreamer, or if they're an internal or external. And use that, and you know, if you have to, write it in your journal, write it down so that you can kind of put it down on paper and see where your particular analysis comes from. And use it. Use it practically every day, and it will become part of you. It'll become like almost subconscious. You'll be able to type women immediately and know exactly how to work with them, how to attract them, and how to have the kind of sexual relationships you want. So now, move on to the sexual roadmap section of the program.